How their segment of our economy is going to perform in the next year and the year after that. And then we can make some prognostications based on that. You will look at the agenda. We will have the afternoon today, all day tomorrow. Then we will meet on the 13th to review the compiled results of this committee. And we should have our homework into to Ray on Monday. So with that, I would ask my co-chairman if he has any opening remarks before we get started.
Thank you, Senator Giddey. Well, I'd like to recognize Kathy Hall-Smith to helping us with our agenda and filling in today. Ray had Houston had a death in the family, and our well wishes with him and his family. He will be joining us tentatively tomorrow, and throughout the rest of the deliberations for this committee, I would welcome the committee and formidable challenge before us. We were very fortunate to have a significant docket with expertise as we go through these proceedings, and look forward to the deliberations, and again, welcome today.
Thank you, Chairman. Ms. Holland-Smith, welcome to the committee. It feels kind of strange to say that to you after you put it together.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to also recognize the work that Ray Houston did in preparing for this presentation, and I'm hopefully the beneficiary of easily going through the prepared materials for you. The chairman have asked that I review with you the information packet that you have, and you do have a copy in front of you. It has really some great information that will support the decisions that you need to make. And just for the committee's benefits, let you know that these proceedings are being streamed, so the audio and the video is going over the internet. All the presentations that have been prepared today for you are also on our website, and that is at the www.legislature.idaho.gov. And on the right-hand side of the screen, it's the Economic Outlook and Revenue Assessment Committee, and individuals can follow along with those PowerPoints. And so in the case for your information packet, if you could take it out quickly, and I will go through some of those key reports that have been prepared for you. Number one, the agenda that you have in front of you is different from the one that's in your information packet, and that has been updated along with the agenda that is on our website. Let's try this. What Ray did is he also left you page 4 to write your notes, but I'd like to quickly go through beginning on page 5. Page 5 is the key economic indicators, and what has been prepared for you are those key factors that drive our forecasting process. And so you have your population history, inflation, farm personal income, Idaho personal income, and employment, along with tax collections and collections to the general fund. So you can see all the data from 2002 up until 2010 on page 5. Page 6 is population by county. Now we have the total numbers, new numbers for the census, and that's on the very bottom of the sheet, but everything else has been updated up until 2009. And you have it listed the growth of our population from 1990 to 2000 and then up to 2009 by county, and you can see where the population we've had gains, we've had losses. Page 7. Is the Idaho gross state product by industry. And the key on this is that it is prioritized by those industries that had the largest change. So if you look at the far right-hand column from 1999 to 2009, you have percentage of total change. You can see those industries that have grown and those that have shrunk. And you can see the relative changes between 2009 and 1999. Now we have a series of pages now coming up, pages 8 through 11, and it's all very detailed employment information. That information will be explained to you by Bob Fick from the Department of Labor. That information really does support his presentation. And I'm not going to pretend to you that I could tell you which each fact and figure in that means. Now, page 12 is what we like to call our bucket report. And this is a long-time project that Ray has loved and nurtured through the years. But I'm going to quickly share with you a shortcut to it. If you look at the top row, what you see is the taxes by the types. And then the middle row shows where all those taxes are deposited. Who's the recipient? Is it the state general fund, other state funds, or local funds? And then the bottom row shows who spends the money. Now, it doesn't show you what they spend it on, but it shows you which entities, who's responsible for spending that money. And we have much, much more information when we begin to talk about budget as to how and what it's spent on. The report following that are the property taxes by class of taxpayer, and that is on page 13. And I think you know as time over time we have changed the rates, we've increased the homeowners exemption, and so you can see that history from 2006 showing the groups of individuals who pay property taxes by class. Page 14 and 15 are also a favorite, and that shows you the collections of the sales tax. It also shows you the impact of the 1 cent, the 6 cent, because the distribution on the 6 cent is different than the first 5 cents. You can see the history, you can see where the money has been deposited or distributed to whom, who the beneficiaries are, and you can see the changes over time. The next really two pages, and you look at them side by side. I hope they're not shooting at me. It's the general fund revenue collections and estimates, and then also on page 17. And this is a report that you're very familiar with. It has the history of the general fund collections beginning in 2003. This is a report that you'll also see in our finalized budget documents and publications, and it shows you the changes in the collection to the general fund over time. And what really is going to be key here, obviously, is that far right column, the forecast for August 2011, the expectation is that that will be changing, as it always does, as soon as we receive the governor's recommendation. I know that Mr. Santos won't be discussing that today. I know you're also very eager, and I don't blame you, to know how December has performed. And as soon as we get that information and able to get it to you in a format that we feel comfortable and feel like is correct, we'll make sure we get that information. But we know that that's very critical in this decision-making process. The next two pages, pages 18 and 19, really show now the revenues as compared to the appropriations. What does the state budget look like? FY 2010 on page 18 shows you how we ended the fiscal year compared to how we thought we would, what the fixes were, and then page 19, Ray has built a scenario not only comparing what happened when we finished our business last session, but what could likely happen if you compare the governor's most recent forecast for fiscal year 2011 and play it out compared as if the rest of the year would continue as we know it now. That's not likely to be the case, but that's something I'll be using tomorrow when I go over the budget information with this committee. And then final pages, just to try to get you a little bit back on schedule, really our show pages 20, page 21, page 22, page 23, 24, all the way to the end of page 25, show this committee what the history of the forecasting process has been. It shows all the individuals who contribute to the forecasting compared to the actual collections. And so there's a little bit of a report card for many of our committee members who've been here for a long time. You can see how close you've been. You can also see the risk we have over time and how quickly those revenue scenarios have changed in the last 3 years. So this is a series of charts and graphs that show that performance. What it does, I think the conclusion that I would come to is it still remains a fair bit of risk in the forecasting process. And then the very page 26 shows the revenues, general fund revenues as has been collected through November this year, in which you are aware that there is a forecasted surplus of $30.9 million. And the very last page is something that was prepared for you as a committee member to record what type of changes you think will occur. And the way that Ray has structured this is that you can either give him a dollar amount or you can give him a percentage amount. You can also break it down by the individual tax types, or you can just give him a single number that you think will be the final collection number. And so if you give him that information eventually when you work with him, he'll be able to take that and build the history of the projections for this committee. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I am finished, and if I can provide any assistance, not only am I here, but Matt Ellsworth, our new analyst, is over here to help me. And I wanted you to know that in every instance in which we have a copy for you, a handout of the presentations, we'll be passing those out. There may be a few instances where we have not received copies and we don't have that, but you will be able to follow on the screen. We have it on our website and we'll get copies for you as soon as possible. And I think also maybe some of you would like some, we're going to try to work on getting you some water. So it's going to be a long afternoon, I think.
Thank you, Ms. Holland-Smith. Questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you again. And committee, that last page, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Holland-Smith, but really the bottom line, the total general fund revenues is the line that Ray would like to see from everyone. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is if you would like to give him more detail, he would like that, but the bottom line is the most important.
Thank you. Very good. Mr. Santos. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I mean, good afternoon. My presentation will be focused on the economy of the state of Idaho and the national economy. I'll go over some highlights of the direction we think both are headed. What I will not be talking about is revenue at this point. That's going to be out to next week, Friday, I believe. I guess the first question I should ask, did everyone get my handouts? I have a packet of those. Terrific. Because as you can see from this first graphic, it's near impossible to read, so you have to follow. This is on page 2 of the packet we handed out to you. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is There's some really good news, and that is the recession is over. In fact, it ended about a year and a half ago. The bad news is it doesn't feel like the recovery started. And one of the reasons for that is a year and a half into a recovery, we still have we're pushing 10% unemployment at the national level. And if you include people who what we call are underemployed, saying they'd really want a full-time job, and some other people, you're closer to 17% underemployment. So the recovery has been slow. In fact, if you look at the handout I gave you, And where it says U.S. GDP, that's the first group of numbers. If you look at where it says 2005 chain weighted, all that is, it's adjusted for inflation. So we're not distorting the numbers with inflation. What that shows you is that you see the recession year there. You see that decline of 2.8%. And then that's followed in 2010 with growth. But the growth is only 0.7%. Very, very mild growth. And in fact, one of the reasons I did the graphic this was I want to present a history. So you can see, look at the past years over the decade, what the growth rates have been. And 0.7 is very, very weak. And coming out of that, we think it'll start picking up speed. But the speed is going the growth of the economy is going to be modest, about 2.5% in fiscal years 11 and fiscal year 12. By the way, all these numbers are on fiscal year, Idaho fiscal year basis. One of the things we like to look at as state economists, we like to look at personal income numbers. Now, if you look at the, and that's the next set of numbers on your table, and what you'll see, again, 2009, terrible year. It declined. In fact, it was it declined 1.2% in that year. And then look what happened in 10. Again, we're recovering, no growth, zero. We think that'll pick up. We think it'll grow by about 3.4% in the next 2 years, fiscal years 11 and 12. Again, by historical standards, pretty modest. I'd like to skip down to the housing starts, because housing plays a key role in a lot of these numbers. One of the reasons that the GDP number is so weak is typically when you have a recovery, housing helps lead you out of it. And it's been the exact opposite this time. Housing has been just weighing down the economy. They have problems that haven't been worked out and need to be cleaned up before the overall economy can jump into a higher gear. And so what you see, again, if you look at, in fact, if we go back to 2007, if you look at Idaho, what is happening, I mean, 28% decrease in 2007, followed by 34% decrease in 2008, followed by a 47% decrease in 2009. Now, we had some hope in 2010. I mean, we had some growth, 8% growth. But we think after this summer, housing didn't grow as strong as we originally thought it would. We had a bad third quarter. So what I did is I reduced my forecast for 2011. And so what you see is almost that 18% decrease in housing starts. Now, if you look at housing starts in fiscal year 12, you see about 76% growth, which seems crazy. But I would ask you to look at the history. Look at the level and look at the history. We're talking about 9,000 units. And that is still at pretty much recessionary levels coming out of that. I mean, we peaked at 23,000 units in 2006, and now we're talking about 9,000 units still. So again, that modest recovery. The next thing I'd like to talk about is what would help housing to grow faster? Well, one of the things we need, well, the thing we need is jobs. And that's, again, if you look at the numbers here, I mean, Idaho's non-farm employment has been declining for 3 straight years. And that's good. The good news is it's tending to stabilize at this point. If you look at the losses we had in 2009 and 2010, they're about 4% a year. We're predicting in fiscal year 11 that stabilizes at about 0.3% loss. That's much milder than we experienced in the past. And then a mild positive 2.2% in fiscal year 12. Nationally, if you look at the numbers, it says a similar thing. You have the declines in 2009 and 2010, big declines. some stabilization in 2011, and when you get out to 2012, accelerated growth, modest accelerated growth. And you know, one of the things to think about when you look at the numbers is it's very natural to look at the numbers now when they've been so weak to say, well, you know, where's the growth going to come from? And one of the things when you analyze the numbers and you look at them is that you can see them. One of the things you can see going on is if you went back up to where it says GDP is growing, okay, output has been growing in the nation. We know that's happening. And we also know that employment for the large part of that time has been decreasing. And that seems like that's not possible. Well, it is when you take productivity into consideration. And productivity simply is how much you get out of a person working. And what's been happening is, if you look at the productivity numbers, you'll see that productivity has been growing very strong, stronger than average, which means, again, in simple terms, we expect more out of employees. The few employees that have jobs are still producing as much. But you can only do that for so long. At some point, you have to start hiring people, we predict we're coming close to that point where this will happen. I mean, one of the things is, I think the cautiousness on the part of businesses to hire, because hiring people is very expensive, and you don't want to do it unless you're absolutely certain that, or as certain as you can get, whether you'll need them down the road. But I think what's happening is because the current job market is being spread so thin that eventually you will have to start bringing on additional employees. Now, if we look down at the goods, so we're in Idaho, where's the growth going to be? Well, the first category you see, the one I've called goods producing employment, that includes manufacturing, mining, and construction. And if you notice, what happens is this one actually I expect will decline again in fiscal year 2011 by 3.3%. And the main reason for that is construction. I still think construction has a way to go before it starts growing again. The good news is we're seeing some positive signs. When housing does recover, that'll give some demand, which will fuel increase employment in the wood products industry. Mining is already expanding in the state. And another good sign is high tech seems to be stabilizing after several years of, you know, heavy losses. Employment in that sector is beginning to stabilize. That's a very good sign. So most of the growth will be coming from the non-good producing sector. And this would include, if you had to make it in big categories, this would be services, trade, and government. Now, of these, I believe services will be the fastest growing. One of the sectors in there is healthcare. And the healthcare sector seems to grow no matter what. In fact, it was one of the few that never suffered job losses. And given our aging population, there'll be more demands on the healthcare system, we'll need more healthcare workers. I mean, I'm sure you've heard that 1,000 times. trade will grow a little slower than services. And actually, government would be the slowest growing. And I can break that down a little bit more. For instance, when I speak about government, it's state and local government in the state of Idaho. So that would be all your counties, cities, state employees. We think that's actually going to be pretty flat, if not fall a little bit. The one that will be steady will be federal employment. We think that's going to hover at about 13,000 people, 13,500 people. We got a boost this summer with the census, but those people are gone now. And we don't see a lot of growth in the next 2 years in those sectors. Now, I will just touch on interest rates a little bit. Monetary policy. We think monetary policy will be pretty favorable, I should say, accommodating over the next 3 years. In fact, the forecast that we buy from Global Insight that we use to drive our Idaho forecast predicts that at the time this one was done, that the Federal Reserve, we keep its federal funds rate, which is the one everybody watches, is now virtually zero, and they'll keep it there to March of 2012. So still a year out, it'll be that loose. One of the things that is another positive for the housing starts will help it is mortgage rates should be pretty favorable. Here they're under 5% in both years, and which I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, interest rates and mortgage rates that low. I can remember telling friends that if you could find one of the 10%, take it. And that was a lot of years ago. Another thing worth looking at, one of the reasons the Fed is accommodating, can afford to be accommodating, is that if you look at the last series of numbers I have, these are some of the major inflation numbers we use. If you look at the forecast, they're well below 2%. Federal Reserve is very comfortable if you use what they call a core rate, which is if you take out food and energy, because they tend to be volatile but short-lived bumps, if you take them out, the Federal Reserve can live with 1 to 2% inflation. They're very happy with that. That would be a nice target for them. So really, there is really no real pressures for them to start tightening yet. Now, one of the reasons is, why is inflation, why do we expect inflation to be so low? Well, that goes back to jobs. One of the things, which is not a part of this display that I've given you, is because the job market is so loose, basically, the unemployment rate is so high, there won't be as much pressure on wages. And with low wage pressure, which is a major driver of inflation at the consumer level, it's just not going to be there. It's not going to be pushing the inflation rates. And that takes care of that table. And I have a couple more slides, if it's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
One of the questions we got was, how is Idaho done compared to other states? And what I have here is, I must confess, this is not something that I put together, but it's a very valuable tool that's put together for us by the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. And this is coincident indexes of economic activity in the state. And one of the things that they've accomplished with this graph is you can compare state to state. A lot of times when you have data, you cannot really compare them state to state because they weren't put together in a consistent way. This one has been. And what this is, gives you an indicator of the economic activity, and this was just published. This is November. This was just published, and compared to 3 months ago. So how's the economy doing? Unfortunately, when you look at it, Idaho is one of the red states. What that says is the growth is, and I can barely read mine out, as much as has declined as much as 1%. That's a But the good news, I guess, is if you look at some of the other states, there are plenty of green states. So those states are actually seeing their economic activity picking up. This next graph is the, I cannot take credit for this one too. This is the brainchild of my predecessor, Mr. Ferguson. And what this one does that indicator I gave you on the previous page, what this does, it looks at it says, for each of those states, when did their economic activity peak, hit its highest point? And how many months has it been since then? And the highest one there, 128 months, is Michigan. The reason is Michigan was already in a recession before the rest of the country was in a recession. Their problems, they had problems with the auto industry and other factors which made them start a lot sooner before everyone else. As you can see, the U.S. is 32 months. Now the latecomer to the show is North Dakota, 2 months. They just recently peaked. They've been growing all along. Idaho is 41 months since it peaked. So if you go from November and you count back 40 months, that's when we peaked. The next graph, when economists look at economic activity, what we like to see is how long has the slowdown been and also how much has it been? I mean, how much economic activity has suffered? Again, what this says is at the peak, what was the economic activity in the peak and what is it now? And that's the percentage change in economic activity. If you look at Idaho, the decline is almost 16%. It's 15.7%. No surprise, Michigan is almost 27%. Nevada, 25% decline in economic activity. And I believe that's the major part of my presentation. I've also included in your handout a more detailed summary of the national and Idaho economic forecast. I just, in interest of saving time, I decided to just publish that and give that to you instead of trying to read across it. So if you have any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Santos. Questions of the committee? Well, I do to start with. On your housing numbers, in November, I heard a presentation at the National Conference of State Legislators, an economist who's presented for the last 2 years, and he said that the sustainable home ownership percentage traditionally in the United States has been about 62%, and at the top of the homeowners market, it was something over 70%. He feels that it's going to go back to the 62% range. Did you take that into consideration when you were looking at your housing starts?
Mr. Chairman, no, I did not. But I did take into consideration other economic factors, for instance, population, which is a demographic number, and also personal income, the ability to pay for the houses, and the interest rates. But also, I would imagine that his number, when he talks about 62, because I just the number just came out, and I think it's about 67%. So you're right, it has been going down. That is correct. But I think over 2 years, I don't know that it will drop that much back down to 62%. But I didn't explicitly put that in there, no.
And Mr. Santos, does the value of the average home have anything to do with your computations?
In this model, no.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee.
Mr. Fick.
How do I do it? Just print this.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Fick. I work for the Idaho Department of Labor. The department appreciates the opportunity to present its assessment of Idaho's economy today. The record-breaking job losses that marked the economy in 2009 ended last winter. Limited job growth early in 2010 brought a return to seasonal job patterns, but the few job gains we experienced were in fits and starts, and they stalled out last spring, just below the, not only the depressed levels of 2009, but below the job levels of 2005. You've lived through these statistics, had to work through these statistics. The economy shed over 50,000 jobs by the time it hit bottom in August 2009. It was a year-over-year job loss of 7.3%. Wages plunged by $1.5 billion, a 6.4% loss. And there was a net loss of more than 2,500 employers from the beginning of the recession at the end of 2007 through the beginning of 2010, a 4.3% decline. Small businesses, those with fewer than 50 employees, bore the brunt of this recession. They provide nearly half the jobs and 44% of the wages in Idaho. From mid-2008, when the state finally started really feeling the recession, through last June, the number of small businesses dropped by 2,500. Three-quarters of that loss, 1,900, came in fiscal year 2009 and translated into 21,000 jobs. Our state's job loss has slowed since then, but even so, another 650 small businesses disappeared in fiscal 10, taking with them 5,300 more jobs. Idaho's job loss since the recession began was among the worst nationally and regionally. At 8.1%, the state's job loss from October 2007 through this October was second only to Nevada and among the bordering state, Nevada among all bordering states, and sixth among all the states. Nevada posted the highest job loss in the nation at 14%, followed by Arizona, Florida, Michigan, and California. The state unemployment rate pushed to 9.5% last February, just a tenth of a point short of the record in December 1982 through February of 1983. The unemployment rate slipped back to 8.8% last summer, but has since moved higher and hit 9.4% in November. The forecast of December rate will be issued tomorrow, but there's no reason to believe that it's going to vary much from the November's 9.4%. That's still just two-tenths of a point below the record of the early 1980s. The job statistics underscore the state's unemployment rate and its standing nationally. With one of the worst job losses in the country during the recession, Idaho has experienced the greatest increase in its unemployment rate. The state's unemployment rate soared from 3.4% in November 2007, the month before the recession began, to 9.4% this past November. It's over 176%. Nationally, the unemployment rate rose 109%, from 4.7 to 9.8. It's old news by now, but that unemployment benefits have been running at near record levels for the past 3 years. And those amounts have been supplemented by federally financed extended benefits. Regular benefit payments at a record of $224 million in 2008, and Idaho didn't even feel the brunt of the recession until the second half of that year. We broke that record in 2009 with regular benefit payments of over $400 million, and while payments have declined in 2010, they were still the second highest on record at $290 million. More than 116,000 workers received benefits in 2009, another 114,000 in 2010. In all, over 165,000 workers have received benefits since the recession began. That's almost a quarter of the state's entire labor force. The state had to borrow because of this demand, $202 million from the federal government to continue paying benefits starting in early 2009 and until last spring, when finally revenues from the employer tax fell in line with the amount of benefit payout. We were among almost three dozen states, to borrow from the federal government because our trust funds went broke. Doesn't look like we'll have to borrow from here on out under the current economic outlook, assuming, as the outlook does, that there's no recession, a new recession anytime in the near future. Completing the trust fund and resorting to federal loans required by law the employer tax rates to hit their legal maximum this past year, 2010. And that's just 2 years after they were at a record low. The rates will remain at the maximum, and the maximum weekly benefit for workers will remain at the legal minimum for at least 5 years. The individual, and you might be hearing from your employers, individual employers will see their rate, their actual rates change, but that'll be because of the way they shift in and out of the 14 different rate classes, depending on their experience with unemployment claims and all the other employers' experience with unemployment claims. It is worth noting that the average effective rate today is, despite these large increases over the past 2 years, is still below the average effective rates that employers experienced in 1983 through 1988 in the aftermath and during the all the recessions of the 80s. With anywhere from 3 to 5 unemployed workers for every job opening in Idaho over the past 2 years, new employment has been eluding tens of thousands of Idahoans laid off during this downturn. In November, just over 52.9% of unemployment claimants exhausted their regular state benefits of 10 to 26 weeks without finding work. That matched the record exhaustion rate of 52.9% in May of 1983. Employers were hiring in 2010, but at the slowest pace they've been hiring since they started reporting their new hires in late 1997. Employers hired only 141,100 workers last year. That's 400 fewer than they hired in the dismal 2009. Up until the recession, the lowest level annual level of new hires was 172,000 in 2003 following the recession of 2001. And the annual average over all of those years through 2008 was over 200,000 a year in new hires. The extended benefits of 28 to 73 weeks that the federal government has financed over the past 2 years plus have been very important to Idaho as Idaho's long-term unemployed workers under these job conditions. The state's jobless benefit program keeps workers in Idaho by providing limited resources that lets them continue to pay the rent or mortgage, buy food for their family, clothes for their kids, and pay the utility bills. The hundreds of millions of dollars, in fact, it's $1.5 billion in the last 3 years in unemployment benefits that Idaho workers have received have gone directly to businesses in their communities. In many cases, that's helped keep the businesses open. The economic modeling specialist firm in Moscow estimates that one job is saved for over $80,000 paid in unemployment benefits. The millions of dollars pumped into the Idaho economy in unemployment benefits have done a little bit to help ease the economic drag of this recession, but by no means have they eliminated the financial struggle for idled workers. The average benefit last year was $240. It's about $6 an hour for a regular work week. Personal income, which is total of all wages, business profits, investment earnings, and payments like pensions and Social Security, declined for 4 consecutive quarters from mid-2008 to mid-2009. It's the first time in over 40 years that there have been consecutive quarterly declines in personal income. The average wage, annual wage, which is already one of the lowest in the nation, dropped 4% from nearly $33,900 in 2008 to just over $32,500 in 2009. And the Census Bureau reported that median household income fell from 2008 to 2009 in 26 of Idaho's counties and was essentially stagnant in 6 more. At the same time, the poverty rate rose in 35 counties. Only 7 saw poverty rates decline in 2009, while 2 held their own against the recession. Clearly, the recession has had a much more stinging impact than department analysts anticipated a year ago. The job growth that we expected to begin in the second half of 2010 hasn't occurred yet, and except for 3 months this last summer, the unemployment rate has consistently been at or above 9%. Idaho fell into this recession relatively quickly compared to other states, and Derek's chart on the coincident index showed the 15-plus percent decline in a matter of 41 months. That's the kind of thing that drove us faster into this recession than others, than other states. And because of that, it's going to be a slow grind coming out. From the time the economy began to lose steam in mid-2006, it took 22 months for jobs to erode to the point that the monthly total was lower than the year before total. That's the zero line on this chart. Then it was only 16 months after that, to July and August 2009, that the loss, year-over-year job loss, peaked or bottomed out, however you want to look at it, at 7.3%. There was a fairly rapid improvement, as you can see by the green part of the line, in the fall of 2009 and the winter of 2010, but it sputtered out last spring, and the economy's just been stuck right there, as the black line shows. There are, as Derek said, there are some signs, and I've heard others say this, there are some signs that the economy is ready to finally begin moving up. Last spring, total wages, using a four-quarter rolling total, increased after six straight quarterly losses. It wasn't new hiring that was doing it was causing the increase. Employers appear to have finally started restoring some of the hours they cut on workers to cope with the recession, and rewarding some of those remaining employees who've taken on extra responsibilities to compensate for job cuts elsewhere. The number of employers also took its first significant upturn this spring since the end of 2008. The net increase was only modest, a couple hundred, but it is an indication that of returning optimism about the future and the possibility of turning a profit. Still, we haven't made any change in the projection that Idaho's non-farm job total will not return to pre-recession levels until 2014. And the recovery of construction, which was the driver of Idaho's expansion from 2004 to 2007, is still 15 to 20 years away. The outlook is for growth, but very limited growth. Through mid-2012, Idaho's job growth on an annualized basis will be about 0.8%. 10,000 jobs over the next 18 months, starting probably early this spring, early this summer, sometime in that area. Construction and financial services, traditionally linked to construction, remain extremely weak spots in our economy. The recession's impact on the tax structure and the politics surrounding it will mean fewer government jobs. Manufacturing, which was another source of good-paying job growth following the 2001 recession, has stabilized outside of wood products and could offer some fractional growth into the future. There will still be sluggishness in administrative and support services. They rely on business expansion for growth. That's going to be slow. And the retail trade will just hold its own as consumers continue to adjust to what many believe is a new and a more reserved economic reality. Population growth drives job increases in education and healthcare. They were the only two sectors in the economy that rode out the recession without losing ground. But population growth is going to be slow, and primarily due to the fact that people can't unload their largest asset, typically their largest asset, and that's their home. We saw it in 2010 when the migration was reduced to one of the lowest levels of the decade, and that probably will continue. The migration rate will continue to a very low level until we see housing prices stabilize and start to strengthen. Idaho's slow job growth will continue to prop up the unemployment rate. The rate in 2009 averaged 8%, the only higher rate since the current statistical method was adopted in the mid-1970s, occurred during the 1980s double dip recession, 9% in 1982, 8.8% in 1983, and 8.1% in 1986. Adjusted for the state's fiscal year, the rate in fiscal year 2010 which ended last June, was 8.6%. Unemployment's a lagging indicator, and that means that as more people become optimistic about finding work and the economy fails to produce jobs fast enough to keep up with that optimism, it'll drive the rate up. And in fiscal 2011, we expect the rate to hit or possibly hit 8.9% before finally beginning to recede in fiscal 2012, dropping down to around 8.3%. While the subject to revision, as more statistical information becomes available, the jobless rates will remain high, especially compared to the record low rates Idaho experienced in the months leading up to the recession. But we still believe that it's unlikely Idaho's unemployment rate will exceed the national jobless rate. Idaho's rate has been below the national rate for more than 9 years now. And I don't know if Kathy can help. Derek showed you the coincidence chart. The Fed also produces a leading indicators chart. And what it shows, if you look back at June, you'll see that Idaho's shown to have a six-month projection forecasted growth positively of somewhere between 1.5% and 4.5%, probably closer to 1.5%. That's in June, and what? That's okay. What that June reflected is that bump that we saw back in the spring in jobs. We had no idea. Go to the fifth one if you can find the fifth one. There it is. This is the June leading indexes, six-month forecast, and you'll see Idaho's there at somewhere between, I think it's between 1.5% and 4.5% forecasted growth in the next 6 months. The next one will show you what happened by August. What June reflected was a blip we had in jobs in the spring. We still don't know why it happened. It's been confirmed by the employer wage reports, but there was, I can't remember whether it was August, April or May, but all of a sudden we had a pop-up in jobs, and then it went right back down the next month. It was across the board. All sectors experienced this little spurt. But once we got back down to where we were, if you knock that out, you see that the indicators in August showed a negative growth of 1.5 to 4.5, and then the last one, which is the November indicator, thank you, for the next 6 months, which will take you through what I think everyone hopes will be the end of this session, next May, 1.5 to 4.5% negative growth again. There are some indicators that suggest things are, we believe things have bottomed out, and there are some indicators that suggest that maybe that there's a start movement back up. But if you look at jobs and that one essentially flat line since April, there's no indication yet that that's happened. And we don't see what the sector is that's going to bounce up and take over the economy and bring it out of this recession as manufacturing and construction did after the 2001 recession. I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fick. Representative McGinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Fick. I'm going to speak for what I believe to be a lot of small businesses all across the state. I hear about cases anecdotally, as well as the rest of us as legislators do, about when an employee is let go for different reasons and then there's a determination for eligibility for unemployment that's made. I'd like to speak to you about an incident in our company that happened in November. One of our employees on a weekend night was out at a restaurant downtown, and excuse my language, but he beat the crap out of two of our other employees. And after the police broke the fight up and sent them all home, this employee hunted him down, went to his home, couldn't find him, and keyed both sides of his vehicle up and down. So when he showed up to work on Monday, we pulled this employee aside and we questioned him about what had happened, and he admitted that he was so drunk that he didn't recall exactly what happened that night, and it's probably likely that he was also on some kind of drugs. So we this individual was arrested for three felonies and is currently going before the court for these crimes. We let the employee go. We fired him for cause, and this is an at-will stay, but we fired him for cause. The state of Idaho denied our our answer. He went to apply for unemployment benefits, and they said that they didn't support our cause for firing him because of the fact that it happened after business hours. But of course, we cited policies in our company manual, which, I mean, if you could imagine what it would be like to show up to work with someone that there's possible, you know, there was bodily assault and could have even resulted in death, if you could just imagine what kind of a working environment that would be. So we determined to let him go for cause, and we cited our company policies that claims to try to support a healthy, working, safe environment for our employees. So of course we were protesting that determination, because when the state does that, then those unemployment benefits are chargeable to our account as an employee. I just hope that you can, I don't know what the process is for the state of Idaho with these claims, and I know that there are always different circumstances, but I don't know if they just automatically deny these claims and have the employee then have to make a case, but I hope you can understand how reluctant the small businesses in our community are to hire people when we don't feel like we're getting the support from the state like we should, when we're trying to make every effort to follow the law, and then we have individuals who break the law, and sometimes it feels like our state is there supporting and protecting those individuals more than the law-abiding businesses and citizens. So I'd be happy to talk to you or anyone from the department further on a one-on-one basis, but this, what you talked about, it's all about jobs and people, so in, especially with the expansion of the unemployment benefits. I mean, people now can be on, once it's determined that they're eligible for unemployment, they can be on unemployment for 2 years, and I sometimes wonder if unemployment is going to be one of our next entitlement programs. And you're right when you said that this is, it's all about jobs and being able to create jobs, and we need to do whatever we can do in the state to support our small business and our big business as well in all these areas, because what we really need to do, all the people in this state and this country, is to just get back to work and be productive. And these are types of incidences that, in my opinion, don't help support the business economy and the business climate in our state.
Mr. Chairman, if you could give me some specific information after we're done here, and we'll have somebody, the Benefits Bureau Chief, will look into the case, and we can get back to you and explain exactly why what happened.
Representative Henderson.
There we are. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fick. I was pleased to see in two or three instances in your report a hint of optimism. And
it's against the nature.
And you said an indication of returning optimism and future prospects for turning a profit. And one of the areas in which you talked about was manufacturing, and the comment was, has stabilized. I just want to investigate those cautious statements a little bit, and I just use the instance in Kootenai County as an example of why I'm questioning the optimism. I don't want to discourage it, but question it. There are three manufacturers in our area that have done well and are doing well. One of them is our office equipment manufacturing company. They were able to maintain a workforce of over 400 employees. The HR director lives across the street from me, so I'm able to visit with that, and they put on 40 to 60 temporaries every week. But I asked her, what is the business that they're fulfilling? And this is the basis of my concern. Their booming business is federal government orders. It's not the private sector that's feeding that manufacturing. We love the business. We like the employment. But my question is, how has your department done anything to estimate the sustainability of those federal orders will they continue to come? I'll move to another area. One of our manufacturers that has replaced all the people they laid off, they had to lay off a year or more ago. They're in a custom mining business, and mining is doing well, but it's doing well because mineral prices, when gold is up so high, silver is up so high, and there's a lot of industries that feed off the metal. Has your department done anything in your statements here say that industries manufacturing is stabilized to estimate the sustainability of those hints of optimism that we could use in projecting revenue for the state in the future? Thank you.
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, I'm not aware of any detailed analysis we've done of whether federal purchasing will continue at the levels it is continuing. I think the assumption is that it will not. I think if any of us could determine where metal prices are going to be in a year from now, we'd all be rich and wouldn't be here at all. So the assumptions that are made in our projections are that there is a slow recovery. It's extremely slow right now. It should begin to pick up early to the middle of this current year, and slowly gain some ground for over the next 24 to 36 months. As the economy does continue to grow, even at a slow pace, there should be a shift, as there typically is. When you have government stepped in a counter-cyclical manner during recessions, there should be a shift away from the reliance on government contracts to the reliance on private sector orders. I mean, that this whole thing about the forecasting is exactly what it is, a forecast. And as I said, if we knew exactly where all those things were going, we'd probably, I'm sorry, I couldn't do any better.
Senator LaFever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Bob. I was pretty alarmed by that coincident index, and just curious if there are any interesting characteristics of some of the states that have really struggled to recover in terms of the mix of employment, and if, in particular, the mix of employment in Idaho is you know, something that we've looked at comparing to other states. I know we're heavily reliant on housing, obviously, for a good chunk of time, and that's not looking like it's going to recover anytime soon. And so just trying, you had said you didn't see any great optimism in any particular sector and taking over the slack for that. But I'm wondering if our mix of employment compared to other states is anything that gives us any hint at what we perhaps have done wrong as policymakers as well, and what we might do better in diversifying and stabilizing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator LaFever, I'm unaware of any analysis we've done comparing the sector mix of our economy with those of states, even surrounding states. We do know that we do know during the expansion that we had manufacturing growth when the majority of states did not, and that was due to trailer manufacturers in the Magic Valley, those kind of things. And then we got hit on manufacturing very hard, harder than a lot of people, when Micron laid off and some of the other layoffs that occurred, and the trailer makers folded down and folded up things down in Magic Valley. In reference to the coincident index, the November index, if you look at the month by month over the past 20 years, just over the last 4 months, Idaho was one of five states that had a decline in the index for the four straight months, August, September, October, and November. The others were Utah, Nevada, Florida, and North Carolina. So I mean, I can see a geographic connection, Utah, Nevada. I don't know how you put Florida in there. And the index is made up of four components: jobs, unemployment rate, wages adjusted for inflation, and then hours of manufacturing. So, I mean, you could be weak in one and strong in another and come out at the same place. I don't know that there's anything that we've done that can tell you whether whether the policies that the state has have fostered good growth or bad growth. The fact is that since 1977 or 78, our percentage of Idaho's average annual wage to the national average annual wage has declined. Was over 85% in 77 or 79. It's now around 75%. A lot of that, there's some discussion about why that's occurred, but you saw the loss of the mills and the mines in the transition of the economy back in the 80s, and it was replaced to a great extent with a lot of service sector jobs, and that has the wage differential there is clear. But that's just what happened. I don't know that there's anything that you could do to have protected the mills.
Brief follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, the one thing you did say at the end of your presentation was that the one area that was growing is services, and I guess that might mean that we might lose more ground then. And do you see any prospect of some of the stronger wage sectors doing better, or are we really kind of doomed to continue that trend?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Faber, there's a great push now on the whole green economy and green jobs. The department is doing an analysis of the green job, the current green job circumstance in Idaho, and the prospects for it, the expansion of green jobs in Idaho in the future. The educational institutions have been the beneficiaries of some federal grant money through the stimulus bill to expand green job curriculum in a number of areas. Wind energy is the one that everybody talks about, and it seems to be the most obvious, and you have some of that going on in various parts of the state. But those jobs tend to have higher wages than service sector jobs, than call center jobs, for example, most call center jobs. So, but I think there is a view that there's a excess capacity in this state, and that if we can find people, employers, businesses to take that capacity and hire people, that's a move in the right direction. It's better to be using the capacity than not at all, even if the job pays less than $17 or so, which would be the average annual wage.
Representative Burgoyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fick, I have a two-part question, really. And that is, from some of your presentation and your answer to Senator Lefebvre, it sounds as though we may be in a situation where we have a group of workers who are just permanently either underemployed or unemployed because they don't have the skills for a new economy. Jobs went away in the 70s, jobs went away in the 80s, jobs went away in this recession. And I'm wondering if you have any comments to make about, are we developing almost a kind of urban economy with permanently underemployed and unemployed people in this state, and whether you see any indication that these workers are getting retraining, getting education for jobs, and whether, if they are, those jobs are going to be here or they're going to be somewhere else.
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Burgoyne, the department is actively involved in retraining workers who've been laid off from jobs that are going away. We've received, I'd have to go back and look it up, but I know it's several million dollars in national emergency grants and in trade adjustment assistance for that very purpose. We just recently received a grant, I can't tell you the amount of it, to do OJT training in to help workers get new skills. And that's just been in the works for about, for several weeks. We've got 17 people involved in that grant now. This is a circumstance where the department pays part of the wage during the OJT period that the employer puts the employee on. So we are, and the Green Jobs initiative is another that the department is actively trying to find find or place workers, idled workers, into skills that will in fact produce make them employable in the new economy as it evolves. I think to a great extent, people are still unsure about where this new economy is evolving. I don't know that anybody can tell you where this economy, what kind of jobs this economy is going to be providing in even 3 years from now. And the other thing is that the director, Roger Madsen, has created a business initiative in an attempt to find out from businesses what kind of skills they, partly, what kind of skills they need workers to have so that they are employable and so that they do have the that they can take advantage of a labor force that is that allows them efficiently to expand their businesses. And that's just been underway for since the fall. And it's starting to really get some traction, and we're getting the there are business specialist teams around the state that are beginning to work with businesses to, among other things, find out what kind of workers they need, what kind of skills those workers need to have, so that, in fact, we are able to, we do have a workforce to meet the demand of an expanding economy.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask one further question?
Follow up.
Thank you. I noticed in a number of your charts and in your comments, we seem to have some improvement. We got an improvement followed by a dip of some kind in this economy and jobs and wages, a number of things. And I was wondering if you had any comments as to whether or not that dip was due to an ending or a decline in stimulus fund dollars coming into the state, or whether it may be more systemic than that.
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burgoyne, I don't know that, like I said, we tried to figure out what caused the blip up in the spring in jobs, and we haven't been able to determine exactly why that happened. And I'm unaware of anybody, any of the analysts who've tried to figure out whether they're to link. I think what you're talking about is the slip in, like unemployment in the summer. I think I don't know that anybody is trying to figure out whether that's linked to anything specific. I think that and of course these numbers are going to be adjusted over the next 2 months as we benchmark the last 2 years because we have better information. But I think if the decline was occurring from February when we hit 9.5% and we started to gradually come down a point a month to 8.8% in, I think it was July or in August, I think when we, if that was occurring, we believe that in the department that that was the natural course and that that would continue. It may level out, but and you know the steps might be longer. It might be 2 months or 3 months between declines, but it would continue to gradually go down as we expected those jobs to kick in the second half of 2010. And I think what was surprising was the fact that it went back up. We have yet to determine exactly why that occurred. The best guess we have right now is that the optimism that improvements in the spring and early summer created energized people to join the labor force. And the economy simply was not creating jobs to meet that increase in the labor force. Our labor force peaked, in fact, last May at 761,000 in the middle of, 3 months after we had the highest unemployment rate in 30 years. So the fact that the labor force is expanding because there's some optimism that there are jobs out there and that the economy just can't keep up with it is probably what drove the rate back up. And we're interested to see tomorrow to see holiday hiring did in December. It was right where it should have been at the five-year average from October to November. The retail sales increased 2%. Retail sales employment increased 2% from October to November. So it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, that seasonal pattern, the seasonality of retail sales continues into December, and then whether there's a real change in the retail sector in January, when typically there's this huge drop-off, and whether that drop-off is going to be less or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Fick.
Mr. Fick, I was reminded that I should remind you that in your current profession, you're not getting paid by the word.
I wasn't before either, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Billy. Trying to, Senator LeFevre.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fick, could you tell me the percentage of those unemployed that are veterans?
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Billy, no, I think they may be able to slice the number down to how many veterans are unemployed, but the survey that's used in Idaho is too small to be able to slice with any kind of legitimate accuracy the unemployment demographics like veteran or ethnicity or age even. It's very difficult to do it when you get down to the very small counties like Camas and Clark and Teton. You can have Oneida, you can have huge swings in the unemployment rate simply because there are so few people there that if the survey suggests even a movement of 5 or 10, you have this big swing in the rate. And so there's no way that we can determine number of veterans.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Fick, would that not be an easy question to put on your questionnaire for people that are filling those out?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Billy, we can tell you how many veterans have filed unemployment claims, but we can't tell you how many veterans are part of the 70,000 people who are unemployed. The number of people unemployed includes not only people who've made claims for unemployment benefits, but also first-time entrants into the labor force, like a returning veteran might be. People who have exhausted their unemployment. Those typically are the ones that you're going to have that are over and above. I think we had 70,000 people unemployed in November, a little over 70,000, and I think there were 3,500 people who got benefits. So about half the people who are unemployed get benefits. Now, I can tell you out of those 35,000 how many are veterans, and I'll be glad to provide that information for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like that information, please.
Representative Power.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fick, when you go to get your information for unemployment, is it all based off of people applying for unemployment benefits, or do you have some other method that you receive that? What I'm trying to get at is how accurate is the unemployment numbers.
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Palmer, are you talking about the unemployment rate to determine the rate?
Yes.
The unemployment rate is based about 80% of the rate is based on the current population survey, which is a survey taken of, I believe, 80,000 households in the United States and 600 in Idaho. Month after month, it's a joint effort by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau, and it changed the people who are surveyed change like they're in for 6 months, and then they change every 20% of them or 18% of them every month, and that's the survey that provides about 80% of the unemployment rate, the number of claims, initial claims, first pays, last pays. That information is also provided and is worked into the rate as well as the non-farm job estimates, but the rate is primarily based on the responses to the current population survey.
Mr. Fick, you indicated 70,000. Does that also include the underemployed?
Mr. Chairman, no. Idaho... trying to think of the Typically, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has attributed about 0.3 of a percentage point additional to underemployed working people who are discouraged workers, 0.3%. So we would be, instead of 9.4, we'd be 9.7 if you threw discouraged workers in, who haven't been looking for a job because they don't think they can get one, and so consequently when they're contacted by the survey, they tell the survey, no, I haven't looked for a job, and so they're not counted as looking for work or part of the labor force. And then there's, I can't remember, and I can get this for you, there's a percentage of people who are working part-time that want full-time work, and that's somewhere between a half and a percentage point, I believe, in Idaho, but I'll get that for you and tell you. Then we do, once a year, we do an underemployment analysis based on application, the job seekers' applications to the Idaho Labor Department system, Idaho Works, and we use not only people who are working part-time and want full-time work, but we also use people who have a degree, associate degree or higher, who have put in, who are working but have a resume in looking for another job, based on the assumption that they wouldn't be looking unless they felt they were underemployed in some way, either by compensation or responsibility or talent use, whatever. That survey was about 12.9%. In 2009, when the average rate was 8%. So that was the combination of part-time and underemployed by desire to have another job was about almost 5 points.
Mr. Fick, how much does Idaho owe the feds from our trust fund at this point?
Mr. Chairman, $202 million and some change.
And I had one more question that may be one that Mr. Eaton will answer in his presentation, but with construction being such an important part of Idaho's economy, or at least traditionally, do you have any information on the inventory of homes for sale right now for months of demand?
Mr. Chairman, the only thing that I'm aware of on that is the information that I heard at the Associated Taxpayers that had Ada County inventory at something like 5 months or 6 months, and the Canyon County inventory at about double that. But I don't know, and I assume that the Realty Track might give you some idea of that, but we haven't tracked it. We don't track it.
Further questions to the committee? Representative Killian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fick, you indicated you don't have data on ethnicity or veteran status. Is there any indication from what you do have whether there are variations regionally within the state of Idaho? In other words, are some areas doing better or some growing and better than the average as you presented?
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen, there are, not based on unemployment data, but based on jobs data, we've seen over the course of this recession that the urban areas, primarily Boise, the Boise metro area, the Coeur d'Alene metro area, have been hit much harder than the rural areas. Lewiston and Pocatello metropolitan areas, which didn't grow anywhere near what the rest of the economy grew during the expansion, have declined much less than the Boise and Coeur d'Alene, for example, have in this recession. We can probably determine. I'd have to check on this. I don't know whether we can determine how by exact location unemployment claims by region. I think we might be able to do that, but I'm not sure. And how that's trended over the course of the last 2 years. I'll have to check on that and get back to you.
Senator Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fick, and I hope I didn't miss this. If you did, just tell me, you'll talk to me later. But what is the department's plan to repay the $202 million loan from the federal government, and what conditions came with that loan from the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Geddes, the conditions of the loan were under the stimulus bill that was passed in 2009. The money was interest-free through the end of 2010. Beginning this year, the interest begins to accrue on any amount that's not repaid by September. And it accrues from the beginning of the year. And I believe the interest rate I saw the other day was a little under 4.1%. The absent any action to intervene in the system will begin charging Idaho employers $21 a employee in 2012. What it is a reduction in the credit Idaho employers are now receiving against the federal unemployment tax for having a compliant state program. It's a 3/10 deduction. Employers, so it's 3/10 against the first 7,000. Employers will be charged $21 per employee in 2012, $42 in 2013, $63 plus 2.7% in 2014. All of that money goes directly to the Department of Labor back into the trust, the loan trust. That's strictly to pay off the loan. There have been some discussions, and nothing has been concrete on this yet. There have been some discussions about a package of modifications to the employment security law that would include bonding that debt and with the purpose of first securing an interest rate that the bond that people say will be a point or more below the current federal rate, and then to essentially defer these losses of the federal tax credit, I call them a surcharge, on employers starting in 2012. They would be deferred until 2016, and the way they're deferred is that the bonds would be issued, that would be paid off. We know the bondholders' money instead of the interest instead of the feds. And then we pay it off over a period of years, 3, 4, 5, whatever. And then at the end of the bond period, as I said, because the fund is broke and we're still in severe demand for unemployment benefits, our rates, employer rates, will stay at the maximum level through 2015. If we were to bond, the rates would stay at the maximum level through 2016, an extra year at the maximum. And that essentially is the way employers would be hit for that deferred money that they would have otherwise paid the federal government directly. The point being that the extra charge would be delayed from a time, 2012, 13, and 14, as the employers are coming out of the recession trying to regain profitability, and then they would pick it up in 2016, presumably, I think everybody hopes, when the economy's back on its feet and is relatively strong and growing again, and they would be able better to afford that extra 1 month, 1 year hit at the max.
Thank you.
There are other components for that to occur. There are other components which would include a change in the solvency factor and some other things so that we could avoid winding up in a debt situation in the future.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you, Mr. Fick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, we have the pleasure of Dr. David Hill from INL. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. One second here. Mr. Chairman, senators, representatives, thank you very much for inviting me here. Let me have the presentation up. From here, what's it going, right? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here to talk about the economic performance and prospects for Idaho National Lab. And I put this slide up. You have, I think, the package in front of you. To make an important point. When we talk about Idaho National Lab, we have two different things in mind, and when I talk about the lab, you need to know which component I'm talking about. In most people's mind, Idaho National Lab is the site, the 900 square miles, the roads, the buildings, and everything that goes with that. On that site, though, there are three contractors plus the Naval Reactors Facility, one of which, the one I work with, is also called Idaho National Lab. As we get into this package, I'll start talking about the R&D component, the part I work, and I'll differentiate that. So on Idaho National Lab, the site, we have Idaho National Lab, the research entity, and two cleanup contractors, CH2M Washington Group International, CWI, and Bechtel BWXT, who operate the Advanced Mixed Waste Treatment Plant. As you can see, there are about 8,000 employees overall, of which the lab is 4,400. In your mailboxes, I'm assured, is this report. It's a report we commissioned from Boise State University. It's an updated one that was done 4 years ago, and it analyzes the contribution, in this case, of all of the contractors, Idaho National Lab site, to the Idaho economy. As I said, there are 8,000 direct jobs, and in the way the economic geographers work, each job, at least here, is assumed or projected to be responsible for another two jobs in the surrounding economy. So overall, the presence of the site provides for about 24,000 direct and indirect jobs, a total economic impact of about $3.5 billion a year, personal income of $2 billion a year. These are largely well-paid jobs. And of course, being an educated community and one that is committed to the local region, you see a lot of other stabilizing influences, civic and charitable causes, and not the least of also a lot of effort to purchase from local companies. And I'll give you the data for the years on that. So you'll see the quote at the bottom, which is from the report of this, that the impact that the presence of the site has on the Idaho economy. As I said, that report is in your mailboxes. You might want to just glance through it. I don't think it's very heavy reading. So what happened in the last year? Now, our year is October the 1st to September the 30th. So fiscal year 2010 finished September the 30th, just passed. So the data here that's in the blue on the business volume refers to that period. And now I'm talking about the lab, the portion of the site which does the research. And in 2010, we grew to $1.06 billion from $870 million the year before. And you can see the prior years. That's a 22% growth. Of that $1.06 billion, about $360 million is payroll. About $290 million is fringe benefits, dental, medical, pensions, all of the things that go with payroll. And the rest of it is procurement, things we buy from other people around here, which is just over $400 million, of which nearly $150 million is purchased from Idaho businesses. So. As you can see, that's the sort of procurement we do in the state of Idaho. Now, I need to dwell on this $1.06 billion number a moment because, as you think you can see just by looking at the graph, it's a little anomalous. And what happened to us was in 2009, the federal government had a very long continuing resolution, which means it doesn't appropriate the money until late in the year. And then in 2010, they appropriated the money very early in the year. Now, what happens in a continuing resolution is we're operating on some level of reduced funding. There are various rules that govern it, but it always turns out that we have a slightly reduced funding, and funding is released on a monthly basis. And when the appropriation bill passes, we get all of the year's money. Well, when you get all of the year's money arriving in June or July, and we don't make profit, we don't make loss, we're accountable for spending the money, and the next year's money arrives in October or November, it creates essentially a mini bubble. And we were put in the position of where we had excess funds and then pressure from the government to make sure it was expended appropriately during the fiscal year 2010, which led to a number in 2010 that was higher than it probably should have been, and a number in 2009 that was probably lower than it should have been. So when we look at next year, which is this year for our fiscal year, we're projecting about $1 billion, which is really flat. Because if you look at the manpower numbers below, you'll see we're not really, from the R&D point of view, expecting much of a change in overall manpower in the Idaho National Lab research. We have grown that employment by 1,100 since Battelle-NG Alliance arrived there, by 1,100 employees, and 900 of that, over, as you can see, in a fairly uniform growth. Even before the recession, we were predicting we'd see a flattening in the lab's overall budget at about this level. So I think you can probably imagine, like any business, we have a number of assets, and there's only so much business you can get out of those assets, if you see what I mean. Even though the business is research, it requires facilities and equipment. So given the certain size of facilities and equipment we have, we'll have a leveling phenomenon. And we had predicted that would happen about now anyway. It's just a little bit lower than we might have otherwise expected. So for 2011, about the same budget, about the same level of employment, but one big caveat. As you probably all know, we're in continuing resolution. And they've just extended the continuing resolution on to March. And with the new Congress, we could all canvass each other and find out what we think is going to happen. And the answer is we don't know. And so what happens to us is we get set on effectively a monthly budget, which is the least of all reasonable possible outcomes. We spend monthly, and when they pass an appropriation bill, the money catches up to us, usually too late in the year to do anything about it. That would really not affect us on the employment side. Where we would pick up the slack there is with procurement, what we spend outside, and on the staffing side through natural attrition. For an organization like ours, we turn over at about 4% a year. 4% of our current number is about 200 people. So we're constantly employing about 200 people a year, and as you can imagine, more uncertain the future, that we slow down the employment rate, we increase the employment rate, this is what happens. So overall, 11 looks much like 10, absent that small bubble, and frankly, 12 looks much like 11, as best as we can tell from this point. We're entering the federal budget cycle for 2012 right now. The Department of Energy, the federal government, has received its what's called its passback, which is the OMB's essentially assessment of the DOE request, which becomes the president's budget. And again, from our perspective, we don't see a lot of scope for large growth, but nor do we see any reason for concern. So overall, from the point of view of the lab part of it, essentially flat for the next couple of years with oscillations, bounce on that depending on local circumstances. As I indicated, we spend a lot of money outside of the lab. Of that $1 billion plus, our procurement outside was over $400 million. And of course, when we were asked, made sure we spent that money, one of the safety valves, as it were, is procurement. And within that procurement volume, we have socioeconomic goals given us, to us by the federal government and Department of Energy. And you can see there, in 2010, we spent about 200 of that $400 million with small businesses. Small businesses, hub-zone small businesses, women-owned small businesses, veteran-owned small businesses, service-disabled. And you can see we are given goals by the government, and we exceeded them across the board and in total. The small business goal for this year, our fiscal year, is at about $162 million, which is, as you can see there, 44.5% of the total. A quick calculation means our total goal for outside procurement is $365 million, which is less than FY10, but that sort of explains that drop from 11 to 10. That's where the safety valve is. So overall, you see a picture of, from the lab's perspective, of a flattening, a natural flattening as well. We, in effect, got no stimulus money. The amount of stimulus money that went to the lab portion was virtually nothing. So there's no stimulus effect in that. I put in here a couple of slides which talk about our construction activities, because tend to think of the destruction activities at the site, the cleanup, but all of the last 5 years we have been investing in new buildings, and of course the local economy benefits because we try and place the contracts with Idaho-based construction industry. So we have there, and I doubt whether many of you have had the opportunity to visit, but you can see the two on the left and right are our two sites, operating sites out on the bigger Idaho site, and the four across the bottom are leased buildings in town at our research and education campus. This is a closer look at one of those sites, and what is happening is that in the barer areas to the right as you look at it is where the cleanup contractor is knocking down buildings. To the left, the ones which are indicated are either the enduring facilities, in this case advanced test reactors, or ones we've built recently or plan to build over the next few years. So what is going on the one hand, we have a cleanup contractor who's taking down 50 or 60 year old buildings. At the same time, we are putting in place modern buildings for our staff to ensure the longevity of Idaho National Lab as an institution and an asset to the nation, and hopefully an asset to the state too. This is the materials and fuels complex. Again, this is the same picture. The gray buildings there are the existing buildings. There are fewer being knocked down here. The orange ones are ones that are being built now, or let me just pick, for example, to the top right is something called Irradiated Materials Characterization Lab. This will be in the vicinity of a $10 million building. We've just issued a request for proposals for that. In the foreground is a technical support building, which is just an office building in this case. We'll shortly be issuing a request for proposals for that. And again, we're modernizing the campus as we go here. And I think most excitingly, particularly for the representatives from Idaho Falls here, this is in town. It doesn't show it, but at the top of the picture would be the Snake River. To the left is south and downtown Idaho Falls, and this is the campus that we occupy there. At the top is University Place, where the University of Idaho and Idaho State University have their presence in Idaho Falls. The buildings in gray we occupy, the ones in orange are ones we have in mind or are in the business of constructing now. In the foreground research and development support, we've actually now occupied. It's a leased building. The one to the right, Energy Systems Lab, this has been one that we have gone through, and a contractor has proposed to build it, and we will lease it. They've got the financing lined up. It's been bonded now. The money was sought in December. The bond sold out in a couple of hours. And as soon as the frost comes out of the ground, we'll start building there. So you're going to see in Idaho Falls the campus grow, hopefully, which will spur other economic development. That's our goal anyway. It's off topic, I know, but I think it's useful to have that overall picture of what's happening. Obviously, education is important to us, and we invest a lot to it. On the right is ESSEC. This is a partnership of ourselves, Idaho State University, and Partners for Prosperity, where we got funding from the Department of Labor, a job training grant, National Scientific Foundation grant, Idaho Public Works. And it's a program at Idaho State University to train technical, what we would call technicians, associates degree level people for the energy industry. And also, we're all finding that many of them, once they get to that level, move on to a full degree level. So it's a feeder program, and we work hard to capture those who have fallen off the academic track, single mothers, other disadvantaged groups, to bring them back in. And this is a very successful program and supported by the federal government also. And obviously, STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics education is very important to us. The better educated the workforce in Idaho is, the better off we are, is our point of view. So it's self-interest, as always. And you can see the numbers there. And of course, the state of Idaho helped with the Center for Advanced Energy Studies case. I don't have a specific view graph on it, but this has been successful. If you were to visit that now, you'd find it's fully occupied. We've actually had to put cubicles down in the front level to occupy all the students that are there, and it's a remarkable success. And a credit to, I think, the federal government, the state government, and the lab working together to get something done that's beneficial to all. I'm now going to turn to the other contractors, the cleanup contractors here. And I should have said before, with us we have Rick Preventure. Rick is the manager of the DOE Idaho operations office that oversees all of the operations on that site, and he can help answer questions on the cleanup and other questions that I can't answer if you have them. So Rick is here, just onto the right here. This is the major cleanup project, ICP or Idaho Cleanup Project. Now this did benefit from stimulus funding. As you can see in the third bullet, they got over $400 million of stimulus funding with 150 or so remaining to be spent. They're exceeding their milestones, cleaning the site out. They have 1,600 employees today, but I think you all know that number is going to be reduced by about 600 over the course of the year. And this is what's supposed to happen. The cleanup contract was supposed to go out of business as they finished cleaning up. This is actually delayed by the stimulus money. So those of you who follow this know that the cleanup contractor would have reduced funding more quickly had it not been for the stimulus funding. And you can see there that the budget guidance for 11 is $242 million, and with remaining stimulus funding, they are moving and really doing an exceptional job on scope, schedule, and budget. At the same time, the safety performance of all of the contractors on the site is excellent indeed. The other smaller contractor is Bechtel BWXT, who operate the advanced mixed waste treatment plant. Again, they're moving. They're beating their milestones. They're ahead of the settlement agreement schedule. Very safe, compliant operation. Their budget is $140 million, 800 employees. And this is a case of where they were able to bring staff on under stimulus funding and manage to retain them by using the natural attrition, and those who left wanted to leave, and so nobody had to leave. And as I understand it, AMWTP is planning to hold that level of funding for the current year, which is the current year for us. So just for those of you who don't follow the headlines, in the Southeast Idaho, we had Secretary Chu visit us earlier this year. That's him in the top right. The person in the top center is Philip Fink, who works for me. The Blue Ribbon Commission is assessing spent nuclear fuel and the disposition in the post-Yucca Mountain environment. Had a public meeting in Idaho Falls. In the picture on the left in the center, that's Professor Per Peterson, who is on that commission. Just a month or two ago in Washington, we helped organize a nuclear energy summit with Senator Voinovich, Senator Carper, Senator Risch, Congressman Simpson, Carol Browner from the administration, and many leading figures from industry about what is the future of nuclear and how can we make it come together as an industry, a government, and research community to get the most out of it. There's a couple of reports. The impact studies I've discussed, and we produced a report a few months ago. Our contract has been in place now for 5 years, so we did a retrospective of the 5 years to assess performance. So overall, we would judge the 5 years and also 2010, at least from the lab proportion, of an extremely successful period. We've grown the lab, almost doubled it over that time, and increased employment by 25% in the lab portion of it. But there's an inherent flattening there. And we're going to have to think very hard about what we're going to have to do to lead to other than inflationary increases, natural increases in both the budget and the employment levels. And the key to that, I think, using Kay's an example, this is a wonderful case of where working together, the state, ourselves, and as agents of the federal government, were able to produce something that benefited everybody. So the flexibility and working together is the key for the future, but I think we have a long and successful future in front of us. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And thank you very much for your involvement in the education initiatives that you are. It's important to Idaho.
If I may comment, I appreciate the thanks, and I'll take that back, but enlightened self-interest is the best motivator.
Questions of the committee? Senator Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Doctor. In essence, then, in terms of the lab and all those other facilities, what I hear you saying is really we don't expect to see any growth. We really expect to see it flattening in the immediate future.
Doctor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hammond, in the absence of doing something about it, yes, our facilities are being used to the maximum. So we're working very hard with the Department of Energy to promote an investment strategy to put in place new buildings and new capabilities that will allow growth. But before we were expanding to fill the capacity we had, and now given the overall federal budget environment, it's a little harder because we have to get investment funds from the federal government. And one of those pictures, the one that says Materials and Fuels Complex, you'll see something called an Advanced PIE Facility or some such name. That's a $200 million building that if we can get it built by about 2015, 2016, will allow us to grow and improve. That is not by any means certain in the current budget environment, although the Office of Nuclear Energy of the Department of Energy and the local office is very supportive, we're still hostage to the federal government and the spending limitations on the overall government. So whilst I'm optimistic that we can increase the physical capacity and therefore increase the economic performance, I can't offer any guarantees to as a planning basis, if you see what I mean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doctor.
Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hill, I had a question on the staffing. On your graph, you're showing a leveling out of staffing in fiscal year 2011. When you talked about the cleanup, you said over the next year or so there would be a decrease of around 600 employees or whatever. Now, is that going to come after fiscal year 2011, or are you picking up additional employees in other areas to even that out?
Chairman, Senator Hill, that sounds good, by the way. The 4,400 is our employment, so this is why I made the distinction at the beginning between the site as a whole and the different entities. So our part of the site, the National Lab, we're fairly confident we can hold it at 4,400. The cleanup contractor, which is additive to this, will go down. AMWP will be about the same. I believe naval reactors will be about the same in the short term, although they have some construction projects on the horizon, but not in that year. So overall, net, a decrease of about 600, but our portion of it steady.
Thank you. Further questions?
Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Hill.
Thank you very much.
Committee, we're scheduled for a 20-minute break. Let's try to make it 15. Our speakers here for the next presentation, if we can be back about 10 after 3. We're recessed. If the committee would come back to order. And our next presentation is from Matt Van Vliet, Clearwater Paper. Welcome to the committee, sir. You need to flip the little switch right there.
Can you hear me?
All right.
Co-chairs and members of the Joint Committee, my name is Matt Van Vliet, and I'm the Public Affairs Director for Clearwater Paper Corporation. Our Idaho facility located in Lewiston is many of you know of it, but I think I want to talk a little bit more today about the continued operation of that facility and how it affects the state of Idaho. I'm pleased to be here today to give a full report after our second year of operation as one of the oldest new companies in Idaho. As many of you know, the company was formerly part of Potlatch Corporation, and we produce pulp, paperboard, tissue products, dimensional lumber, and green power, green electricity at Lewiston. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to bring you up to date regarding our second year in business in Idaho and provide a glimpse of what we hope will be a solid future. Clearwater Paper is a 2009 and 2010 Idaho success story, and the workers, suppliers, the management of Clearwater Paper are working hard to make 2011 another outstanding year. I have a short PowerPoint presentation, and then we'll stand for questions. We've provided handouts, and I think everybody has them. So without further ado, I'll move forward with the presentation. I want to start off by kind of giving some key highlights of the company and what we're about. Because we have spun off in the last couple of years, there's still a lot of questions from a lot of people on which company is doing what and the fact that we are two separate companies. But Clearwater Paper is a leading producer in a lot of attractive niche markets. The company is focused on growth, And some of the reasons that that growth is in our future is that we are the number one producer in higher margin at home private label grocery tissue. So that's the retail grocery stores that a lot of us shop at. And when you go in there, and you'll never see our brand in there, but you'll see their brand names on it, and that tissue is something that we produce. All of our products, we focus on the high quality premium products. And another thing that positions us for growth is that we do have very long-standing customer relationships that we've learned from, and then we try to build into as we move forward with new customers. We have a conservative financial profile, and the company is appropriately leveraged. And I'll give you some numbers about that later on. And lastly, we do have a very seasoned management team that has been put together with a lot of folks that come from not only forest products industry, but other industries. Some are out here out of Boise, and very good people, and very seasoned. So 2010 brought a lot of new things for the company. And some of this may be new for some people, and some of it may be old hat already, but we broke ground on a brand new facility in North Carolina, a $280 to $200 million tissue facility. So that was one of the very first big efforts that the company moved forward. And I'll explain more about that in a second, how it relates to Idaho. And as of a couple weeks ago, the last week of the year, we completed an acquisition of a company called CelluTissue for $530 million. And we've gone from having 7 manufacturing facilities last year to 16th, and that 17th is actually the new facility being built. So we are now a much larger company. We're now in 12 states plus Ontario with a truly national manufacturing sales footprint, something we didn't have before. So that's the map. Previously, up until a couple...
Seems to be moving on its own.
Previously, up until a few weeks ago, we were basically in Idaho, one operation in Nevada, one in Chicago area, and one in Arkansas. As you can see, we've grown quite a bit in just the last couple weeks. So more about Lewiston itself, and these are the updated numbers. I tried to bring you numbers year to year so you can see if there's much of a change, and for the most part, there isn't. We employ 1,600 employees, full-time people in Lewiston, and there's really been no change from year to year. We've added a few people, and some of those people have been moved on to other operations, so it's really holding steady. And that's a breakdown of all of the different groups. Our payroll is up in Lewiston, and we've come up to $96 million is our annual payroll out of just that facility. Always think it's kind of interesting, you know, you look at the payroll numbers and you think that's one of your biggest contributors to the community, but these are the real telling numbers in my opinion. The LC Valley alone, so that's Lewiston and Clarkston for the most part, our numbers from 2010 were $44 million. Those are numbers from vendor payments. That's the checks that we wrote into those towns. So we wrote checks of $44 million. Southeast Washington, without Clarkston, we wrote checks of $57.5 million. And Idaho as a whole, without Lewiston, without that payroll number, we wrote checks of over $101 million. So outside of the payroll, we wrote checks of over $203 million to vendor payments in the region. So these are our estimated taxes for 2010. About $4.1 million for personal property tax and real tax payments, about $1.2 to $1.5 million. That's not estimated. That's a year-on-year average for corporate income tax, similar to the past year. And estimated for 2010, about $1.6 million for sales tax, which historically, over the last few years, we've assigned over $1 billion of sales to just the Lewiston facility alone. Lewiston, we produce 3 different product lines, and we do have a power generation facility. And I'll go through those real quickly to give you an idea of where they stand right now. Our consumer products division, that's the division of the company, the tissue division that's growing so rapidly. That business grows at about nationally about 2% per year. It just tracks population growth. And as the population growth increases, people increase their use of tissue. And we make all types of tissue, from bathroom tissue to paper towels to fancy dinner napkins. And after the acquisition, our range of what we can produce is really broadened also in the world of tissue. But that's a good business, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in a second. Pulp and paperboard division, that is bleached paperboard, and Lucen, about more than half of the of our employees there work in that division. And bleached paperboard are things like, think of very high quality graphics that on boxes, on packaging. So cosmetic containers, liquid packaging for milk and even sake containers, things that that need really high quality graphics on the outside, that's what we produce there. We also produce market pulp, and we send that overseas when the market is right. We'll fire up our pulp dryers, and if it's profitable, we'll send that overseas. And we do have substantial international sales in just pulp. And we have one sawmill. And our sawmill is smack dab in the middle of the complex, surrounded by pulp and paper operations. And there's a reason for that. I came up here last year and we talked a little bit about how the lumber industry had been really hurting, and because it's so tied to new home starts, and so is this mill. It's very much tied to new home starts. But one of the things about this mill, we produce a full array of species of fir products and cedar and coal and cedar specialty products. But the difference is that this mill delivers chips directly from it into the pulp mill and delivers hog fuel directly from it into the pulp mill. So that byproduct of chip and biomass fuel production has really bolstered the sawmill's performance, and it's helped it through these tough times in the lumber industry. Not unlike most of the sawmills in the state. The sawmills in the state and the pulp mill in Lewiston are all very closely tied together in many different ways. We purchase a lot of chips and hog fuel from those folks and from all the sawmills, and we all work very closely together. It's a very very dependent organization when it comes to fiber moving throughout the state of Idaho, especially the North State. But the lumber business is still tough, and we're moving through it. There are some shining lights out there. Some people are doing pretty well. Some mills are doing better than others, and we're just slowly see that getting a little better. A little bit more about power generation. That's kind of our byproduct at the mill. The company has a 63-megawatt green power generation facility. We've been generating power in Lewiston and selling it for more than 30 years. We're really the largest, I believe the largest biomass facility that there is in the Northwest that does what we do. And our facility was built in 1980. We sell about 50 megawatts per year, and the green credits with that to Avista through our PRPA contract. And we really could produce a lot more green power if we could find cheaper, more reliable supplies of woody biomass at more market pricing. We're working on a PRPA contract right now that is, we're getting probably half of what we should today in our payments for our sale of electricity. We could be getting a lot more. So, and that contract is, I think we have 3 more years on it. But the other thing about the wood stream in Idaho, we believe, and we've talked a lot about this, is that what's in the wood stream now is really what's in the wood stream. We are encouraging and hoping that we add more to it, but there are really no surpluses out there. So we're very reliant on that wood stream. We actually source wood to run that power facility up to 300 miles away and bring in hog fuel and chips, but because we have such a good network of chip moving around the state. We could also move some hog fuel, but it's really, we go a long ways for our fiber. Reliable waste wood, woody biomass is a challenge, but our major concern is that subsidizing woody biomass may result in burning paper-grade wood chips for energy, and it's always been a concern of ours because that's happening in other states around the country right now. If you, a wood chip is worth a lot more than woody biomass, but if you subsidize it, your wood chip is going to end up being about the same price, so that's always a concern of ours. But more than anything, affordable wood chips for making paper remains our number one concern, and sourcing other facilities or plants around the region in an ever-changing regional fiber market will put a strain on both our paper business and our power business. We are do a very good job of managing our fiber supply, and we don't see any immediate issues with that, but it's something that's the lifeblood of our operation, and we're always focused on it. So a little bit about positive characteristics of these businesses and why we've been able to come up here and give a success story for the second year. We are the premier supplier of store brand tissue in the United States. Before the acquisition and before we actually produce anything in Shelby, North Carolina, we produce approximately 56% of the U.S. private label products sold in grocery stores. So that's across the United States. If you're in the western states, 16 western states, that number jumps to 90% plus. So pretty much any retail grocery store that you walk into, if you go in and you get one of their store brands, it's probably coming from us, and it's probably coming from Lewiston for around here. We believe that we continue to benefit from the value-oriented customers shifting to private label products out there throughout the entire recession. We've seen people move more toward private label. It's not just in the tissue business, it's in all grocery store products. But in our business, we've been able to consistently match the brand quality of, or the quality of the brands that are out there, and people have been able to make that jump and get a much better price on a product that is quality just the same as some of the brands that they've used before. We still see shifting, and we think that people are going to be very used to these brands after the recession is over, and a lot of people will stick with them. Our customers include the top three national grocery chains. I think it's top four now. And our U.S. private label tissue business is growing for 14 consecutive years. So that should give you a pretty good idea why we're focusing on growing that part of the business, which is now will be about double any other part of the business. We have long-standing relationships in both of these businesses, and our consumer products segment, that's the tissue group, of about 26.5 million cases of the 30 million cases we produce annually, that goes to about 10 customers. So it's a lot of product to a very small group of people. That means our customer service has to be really top-notch. The average length of our customer in the consumer products group is 20 years. Our new Shelby plant will add about 10 million cases to that 30 million. And our study tissue acquisition, which just closed, will add a lot of cases, a lot of parent roles, and various synergies and new channel businesses. So it's going to give us more product to work with to better supply our customers and look at new customers, but it's also going to allow us to enter some new markets that we've never been in before. And that should add a lot of breadth to the company.
Mr. Van Vliet, just so you know, you've got about five more minutes for your presentation.
Great, thanks. So paperboard. Paperboard is the other part of our business. We account for about 12% of U.S. bleached paperboard capacity in the U.S. Customers include high-end packaging businesses, like I mentioned. And it's also been a stable demand for the product for 14 years. Bleached paperboard, not a lot of players in it, doesn't get affected by violent paper cycles like other commodity paper products. That's another reason why we've had stability in Lewiston. That group has about over 100 customers. I think close to probably 200 customers around the globe with varying amounts of deliveries, much different than tissue. Tissue, small amount of customers, a lot of volume. And the average length of customer in paperboard group is 26 years. So our growth is still focused on consumer products for the most part. We're capitalizing on growth areas. We're penetrating new grocery markets in the Midwest. New plant that was built on the Southeast was the Eastern, was really to service the Eastern Seaboard, and the acquisition of Cellular Tissue to form a national manufacturing footprint. We've always had a national sales footprint, but now we have a national manufacturing footprint. And paperboard business is really about focusing on productivity, improving our mix of high margin products, and increasing profitability and lowering costs. So we've had about $800 million invested in 2010, and although I'm here to report that our Lewiston operations are doing very well, you know, some of you may be asking why hasn't some of that $800 million of investment come to Idaho, and there's some real logistical reasons for that. First of all, the two growth opportunities were in the South and the East Coast. We actually are been out in this part of the country for a long time, so growing the Lewiston to supply this market was simply not a logistical option. It just couldn't work. But all Clearwater paper mills compete annually for a finite amount of capital to fund mill projects, and Lewiston has always competed well against other locales in the company. The difference now, really, with the growth of the company, is that Lewiston has to compete against six other facilities in the company. Now they're going to compete against 17 for that same capital. So how is it going to cost? How's it going to compete? It's really about cost. In commodity business, it's cost, cost, cost. Our business operate on very long-term horizons. Cost of fiber, labor, chemicals, environmental compliance, and taxes. They're all accounted for when we calculate the investments that we're going to be putting out into any of our operations. We really focus on having a stable, predictable tax policies. That's really where we need to be looking way off, hoping that we can see these things coming. We know we're going to get new taxes. We know we're going to get new changes. But how far out there we can see it and adjust for it is what's important to us. Same thing with raw materials. We need to have a stable, reliable source of raw materials that's priced competitively across the country. Threat to fiber loss makes for unpredictable investment opportunities in any of our locations. And same thing with environmental policy. It's about being able to look out a long ways. Small changes in environmental policy and rules cost a huge amount of money at the facilities. We can deal with that. It's just that we need to see it out there, plan for it, and handle it in the most cost-effective way possible. I'm probably close to out of time. But okay, so just the last numbers. About 2009, $1.25 billion in sales. That we will be pushing $1.9 billion moving forward. We're expecting to start production in a new facility in Q3, and that will add to the bottom line. Q1 earnings are $0.5 million, Q2 were $20.6 million, and Q3 of this year were $15 million, so the company is doing relatively, comparatively well. For last year, I don't have Q4 numbers because we have not released those yet. That's our liquidity numbers, and that most of that's going to change after we release those numbers in September. But the company is well structured. And lastly, the overall shape of Clearwater Paper in the last 2 years, and since last year when I was here speaking last, the company is very strong and is growing. Workforce is experienced. The company is diversifying into some new channels through acquisition, and we're committed to continue business in Idaho. So I hope I've presented a not much different situation as we were last year. The company is very stable and doing real well, and looking forward to another good year working in Idaho.
So, Mr. Van Vliet, then if I hear you correctly, you're kind of expecting Clearwater to stay fairly flat as far as revenue projections for the next 2 years. Is that what I'm hearing?
Due to a lot of SEC regulations, I can't really answer that question. But what I can say is that the company is strong and growing, and we're very stable.
Let me reword it then. Speaking for the industry, do you expect your paper industry to remain flat for the next couple of years in the state of Idaho?
Well, we're the really one of the only mills in the industry when it comes to the paper industry. The company's doing well. There are no we don't plan any surprises, and we don't see any surprises on the horizon. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Questions of the committee.
Senator Fulcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Van Vliet, I noticed that you recently had the opportunity to break ground in Shelby, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Just curious to know, during that experience, from a business environment perspective, anything that you could share, positive or negative, doing business in North Carolina versus Idaho?
Mr. Van Vliet.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
It was our experience in the siting of that facility was really amazing. I really can't compare it to Idaho because we haven't done a lot of siting of new facilities. We've only grown facilities that we've had for the most part here. But we were truly awestruck by the welcome that we had in North Carolina. It was truly amazing. We had over $50 million in incentives to come in there, and we worked very hard on each of those from the very first visits to the location to the very last. We felt like we were treated like royalty, basically. Every promise that was made to us from the beginning, the very first day we showed up there to today, the follow-up from the governor herself has been significant. We are constantly called by different members who were part of the group that tried to bring us there, and making sure that they are following through on it, on all of their promises, and it's absolutely true. There are a lot of things that were offered up that we weren't sure we were actually even going to use, but a lot of education, training, workforce improvement aspects of the package that we are using everything, because they have proven from beginning to end to really fulfill every promise that they've had. It's you'd have to be there to really understand it. The day when we were the day that the company was unveiled there, governor came to the town, announced it, standing room only, literally hundreds of people packed into an auditorium, people out the door into the street to listen to find out who the company was that was coming and offering 250 new jobs in Shelby. Shelby is right outside of Charlotte. It's about a 30-minute drive out of there, so it's pretty close to metropolitan area, but was a big textile town in the south, and a lot of that's gone away. But it's really hard to explain how genuine they made us feel. We looked at 100 sites, and it took a long time to bring it down to the final ones. And the way that I think I can describe it best is, with the two final sites, one of the sites really, one of the locations really wanted us to be there, and another one really needed us to be there, and it was the one that really needed us that came through loud and clear. So. I hope I answered your question. There's a lot of details on how we were quartered and how we were brought in, but it went very well and continues to. They call it aftercare there. They call it aftercare, and it's not just the promises up front, but it's all the follow up after you've arrived.
Further questions, Senator Hale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Matt. Congratulations on all that substantial growth, and I heard you talk about what that means for Lewiston. Could you broaden that a little more? What does that mean for the state of Idaho in terms of having a major operation in Idaho? Does it strengthen the operation here? I understand that it's got to be more competitive, but help me understand how that benefits Idaho.
Mr. Fenway.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Well, first of all, we just closed the acquisition about 2 weeks ago, so we're going to be finding out a lot of different ways. But we expect there to be synergies in the way that we operate across the country. Lewiston is half of the company, so it's a huge part of who we are. So
there's going to be a lot of different ways to look at how we fill the needs of our customers and the markets. There are people in Lewiston who are going to have great opportunities to move and grow throughout the company, because that's where a lot of the experience and brain trust is in our company. And there's a lot of people from other locations that are going to have the ability to move to Lewiston and really learn our business inside out there too. Some of the real benefits that we think we're going to see out of the acquisition are going to very much strengthen the operations throughout the company and through Lewiston. The strength of the company, when half of the company is in Lewiston and we're strengthening it, it's more than the same.
Follow-up, Senator Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Matt. So would you say then, would you characterize these acquisitions as strengthening the long-term operations and forecast for strength of operations right there in Lewiston? Mr. Chair, Senator, it's really a strengthening overall of the company. And as we become more competitive, as we can spread our footprint across the company or across the country, we can remain a viable tissue company. We were, before the acquisition, we had a national sales footprint, and a lot of that was right out of Lewiston. So we had people working across the country, but we couldn't supply all of the opportunities. So we were limited. So now we have a national footprint, we have a national sales footprint, now we have a national manufacturing footprint to help fill that out. So it's one and the same, really.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Matt.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Van Vliet. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that concludes my presentation. Thank you again for having me this year. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and bring you all up to date on where we are.
Thank you.
Mr. Eaton. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. We'll get set up here for the record. My name is John Eaton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Idaho Association of Realtors. It is always a pleasure to present to you. Okay, perfect. Here we go. Before I start, one of the questions that the chairman asked about was homeownership rates in Idaho earlier today. And I didn't have it in my presentation, but I did hear it online, so I did bring a copy of a chart for you folks. This is the national homeownership rate. As we have seen it projected out, this is from a presentation by our national economist, Lawrence Yoon, that was given just 2 months ago. And you'll see that it's sitting at about just over under 67%. In Idaho, I think we're right at 68, 69. We usually run 2 to 3, 4 points ahead of the national average, a little bit in Idaho. So I think, you know, historically, if you go back into the 90s, we were running right at about 64, and then we've seen an increase in that. In Idaho, we stay a little closer to 70. And we were up well above 70 at one point in the last few years, but we are back down, I think, just below again now. So just to start off with that, that's some information that you'd ask for. Real estate and construction industries do remain one of the largest sectors of the Idaho economy, generating tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue for the state through both sales and income taxes. Active construction and real estate markets at the local level generate millions for local governments in new property tax revenues. Real estate and construction accounted for 17.9% of the Idaho gross state product in 2009. So if you go on to the information that was given to the committee as part of the information packet, you'll see there that real estate rental and leasing in 2009 was 12.8% of the gross state product, and then you add in the construction at 5.1%. The 12.8% is a 0.5% increase over 2008. So it's gone up just a little bit in the real estate rental and leasing section, and construction has stayed the same. We did sell more homes in Idaho in 2010. I'm just going to give you a snapshot of some of the markets. I'm not going to go over the entire state, but we had an 8.2% increase in sales in Ada County, a 29% increase in sales, so this is over 2009, in Canyon County, and a 38% increase in Twin Falls area. Now, these number of homes that were sold in those markets were comparable to 2001-2002 numbers. That is pretty much indicative of the state. But we do see continued price declines. Even though we're selling more homes, they're selling for less money. So in Ada County, the average price, which is what we've been tracking for years before we had ability to do median through our computer systems, was down 5.3% to 188. You'll see the median was 155. Canyon County, this is the same markets I just showed you, were down 5.1% to 108 with a $93,000 median. And Twin Falls was down 1.4% to 135,000 with a $125,000 median. So, as I said, for the second year in a row, we're selling more houses than we did the previous year, but for less money.
Those percentages were just for the last year?
Difference between 2010 and 2009. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you. A large percentage of home sales that we are selling are distressed properties. So in Ada County, of those homes that we sold, 17% were short sale or foreclosure, and 30.14% were what we call REO or bank-owned properties. Canyon County, short sales and foreclosures, 16.7%, 51% of the sales were bank-owned properties. Twin Falls, 5.54% of sales were short sales and foreclosures, and 25.6 were bank-owned properties. So you get the picture around the state. It's a little worse off here in Canyon County and Ada County. You'll see that, I think, reflective as well in the numbers that you guys were given. It's on page 11 of your handout, where you look at the unemployment numbers in the areas around the state. And if you look at our major urban areas, Ada County's at 9.5% and Canyon County's at 11.5%. When you get to some of our other major metropolitan areas, like Bannock County, you're at 6.7% unemployment, 5.8%. This is predictions for 2012, I'm sorry, but you'll see 2010 was 9, it's pretty much the same, 9.2. You're a little better off in areas like Latah, Madison, Nez Perce, and Twin than you are in Ada, Kootenai, and Canyon. So it's somewhat regionalized, and some of that is because our housing market is different in those areas. Our membership levels, you always ask about, like I said, home sales are at 2001-2002 levels, and our number of realtors is closer to our 2005 levels, just over 6,500 realtor members. Some of the national numbers I always throw in, we just had at the national conference in November. This is Lawrence Yoon, who is our chief economist for the National Association of Realtors. Consumer confidence, present conditions, he labels as awful. You'll see it down there in ranges from where we saw in 1982, 1992, 91. But the difference is when you go back to those 82 times and you look at consumer confidence on future conditions, it's not as good as it was back when we had 9.6% unemployment in those times, but it's not as bad as it is in other areas. So there is some hope there. Business spending shows weak confidence in relation to profits. So what you'll see historically is business investment has that sort of relationship to corporate profits that has stayed the test of time over the decade. Currently, they're not investing. GDP is growing, but without much vigor. You'll see that. I think you probably already saw that today. U.S. private sector job gains are actually up. You'll see the dip that we had in the recession there. Total payroll jobs in the U.S., we are sitting at the same as 2000, but with 30 million more people. There is a real estate tie-in there. How many years to get the job market back to normal? Well, if you go back just a couple of slides, you'll see that, let me see if I can go back here real quick. From January to September, we added 863,000 jobs, U.S. private sector jobs. Now, if we add 100,000 jobs a month, which is about just a little more than what we had added this year, we're treading water. If we add 200,000 jobs a month, it's 6.3 years to get back to a normal job market, and you can see the other numbers there as well. Existing home sales are starting to normalize a little bit. You'll see the trend line is more about where the average is. Other measures are starting to show price stabilization. You'll see the bubble there is fairly significant, but if you had followed that through, it's getting back up to where it would have normally been. Those are two different groups that track home prices. Home price to income ratio. This is where you saw the bubble the worst, and it is a very interesting dynamic because it leads to, with the pent-up demand of having 30 million more people than we had 10 years ago, but having prices sort of in the same level, you've actually got the average person has the average house costs 2.4 times the average income. So, you know, normally when I was buying my first house, they wanted to make sure it wasn't more than three times the cost. We had gotten over that as an average of your income. We're back down to historic lows as far as how much income people are making and how much the average house costs for housing affordability. Here's some tales of that from around the country. San Diego, Miami, you'll see the difference from 2005, which was the height of the national real estate market. In Idaho, we were a little behind that. Economists expect price increases in upcoming years. Macro Markets is a firm that goes around and surveys 100 different economists about home price outlook that deal in this industry. It's something that we use, something that Wall Street Journal and others use. You'll see that they predict just minimal growth for the next 3 years as far as home prices go, 4 years. Moderate GDP expansion is expected 2 to 2.5% in the next 2 years. This is the outlook that was baselined from our economist. Historical average is about 3, so it's a little below average GDP expansion. 1.5 million annual job additions in the next 2 years. That's a little below 100,000 a month that we need. Unemployment rate, they expect 8% in 2012 and normal in 2015. Mortgage rates rising to 5% in 2011 and 5.9%. You know, it's that people fussing about home values can miss out on lower rates. A 1% increase means a heck of a lot more in your bottom line than a few thousand dollars on the home sale price. Home values, no meaningful change in the national price in the next 2 years, as we said. Home sales to be choppy, but overall improving in line with job growth, and that's the key we'll talk about in a minute. Affordability conditions are very compelling, as I said. This is one of the best times for people that have jobs and are stable to buy a house. There is some pent-up demand with those additional 30 million people. Idaho housing baseline. Our realtors are active and working. They're selling more houses this year than they did last year. But again, prices are down and sales are moving up. We do have an excess of stock in the major markets, although I think somebody had asked about our months on I guess it would be our attrition rate. It's about 6 months in this area, in the southern Idaho. Which is better than last year when we were sitting at 9.5, I think it was. So we are building some of that off. We do have a bunch of distressed housing that we still have to work through, and that is what is causing the lag in housing recovery, is dealing with all those properties through the bank processes, through all the other processes they have to go through to get them sold and get them back on the market and out. It's not something you go in and say, I want to buy that house, and 2 weeks to a month later, you're in the house. It takes quite a bit of time to get through the process with these banks. Idaho will likely lag behind the national recovery in the housing sector. We did not lead the nation into this recession, and we're probably not going to lead them out, but there are things that we can do to help ensure that we are positioned well within our state in order to have the best opportunity to do so. And by that I say, you know, the top of the market nationally was 2005, 2006, and here it was about 2007. So we were a little bit about a year behind some of the other national markets. We expect flat growth for budgeting purposes. We likely won't see the 2005 levels before we went into the larger increases in prices for 2 to 4 years if we're looking at our national numbers and we follow those trends. But there are things that we can do to mitigate that. In Idaho, the job recovery, our recovery from our economic recession here, it's all about jobs. Businesses nationwide are not investing in new employees at the moment. They're not spending. Business spending will not recover without more certainty in the marketplace. The real estate sector will not expand without new job creation. New jobs equal more demand for housing, more consumer confidence, and more mobility. Some of the solutions are beyond our control. They're federal in nature. But there are areas we can focus on to give Idaho an advantage in the job market. What's creating some of this uncertainty in the national marketplace? Our federal tax policy is not stable. We just heard some discussion at INL about all these continuing resolutions and other things that they're doing. We just had a 2-year extension of some tax cuts. Whether you agree with that or not, 2 years doesn't provide any certainty to the businesses that are going to invest. They don't know what the case is going to be 2 years from now, maybe when they finally have their plant built, and what their costs are going to be at that point. The increasing deficit and our debt has a drag on the economy. That is something that is going to have to be paid off, and as businesses look at that, they say, how is this going to happen and how will that impact our business? They're leaving some of their money on the sidelines. The health care bill is a major concern for business expansion in general. We don't know what the rules are going to be or what it's going to cost industry. You know, as Mr. Van Fleet said, if we know what those rules are going to be, we can sometimes build those in, but we don't know what those rules are going to be. And until that certainty is provided to the marketplace, we're going to have continued instability in that area. Same thing with the new banking regulations that were just approved. Many of the folks that deal in those areas, and we deal with a lot of the financing issues on that through Fannie Mae, HUD, all these other places, they don't know what they are yet. They don't know what was in that bill that just passed. We're working through that, but it will take time to get that certainty and get the market operating on that. A certain market. Same thing with cap and trade. Nobody knows where that is going, what will happen. All of these things are sitting out there. The mortgage interest deduction has been talked about for elimination at the federal level, or at least for some folks. Our research shows that if that happens, it's a 15% reduction in home values pretty much overnight. And we do have some state-specific numbers on that as well. Reckless spending and debt at the state level will require large states level, not Idaho. Put it that way, will require reductions in state spending or higher taxes. Specifically, if you look at the case of our neighbors in the West, Oregon to an extent, Washington to a great extent, and California to the nth extent, they have a we heard from Governor Little at the Associated Taxpayers Conference, I believe they have a $500 billion unfunded liability in their pension system. The businesses don't know how that's going to be paid for or who's going to pay for it. And when they're thinking about expansion, that's something they consider. What are our future costs going to be? There are many states that are going to have to deal with these issues. That is an opportunity for Idaho. We are positioned well because of some of the decisions this legislature made regarding their budget. Business spending, we just had a report 2 weeks ago from CNN Money. It was and you can find it from Moody's, who did the report. There are $1 trillion in cash reserves sitting on the sidelines in corporations in our country right now. Some of them, like Cisco, have upwards of $40 billion in cash reserves. Now, there's reasons for that. It's partly due to future liabilities and uncertainty. They don't know if they want to invest in a new plant right now. It's partly due to the lack of a perception for need for products with low consumer confidence. They don't know if there will be a market for the products if they build them. And it's partly due to higher debt ratios in the non-financial sectors. So some of that money is sitting there, but they do have debt securities that they're invested in. They can't just spend it without selling those to somebody else. So it's not all cash sitting in the bank. But there is pressure to invest by their investors, by Wall Street, by others. You're seeing, instead of maybe investing in new businesses, stock buybacks, mergers, dividends are all on the increase this last few months. We have lower unemployment, job creation through business investment translates into more job security, which translates into higher consumer confidence. That's the ultimate goal here, is to get that job creation going by investment through business so that we can get some more security in the marketplace. What can the role of the Idaho legislature be in doing this? We already talked about our budget and the things that you guys have done to maintain a stable environment. Many of the challenges, again, are going to occur at the federal level, but we are well-positioned. Things we can do, focus on business recruitment and incentives. Make sure our fundamentals are sound and maintain certainty to encourage investment. And prioritize your investments as the economy recovers, and hopefully we're getting some more dollars in, and we've dealt with some of these things in the next maybe 4 to 5 years. Look at where you can invest those tax dollars into the state in order to provide the biggest return on investment. We've done some of that with our energy capacity. We've talked about it a lot with our transportation capacity. We have looked and had discussions about economic diversity within the state. You know, we're very much an exporting state. We don't manufacture a lot here in Idaho. That's something that you can encourage through tax policy and other things. We have made significant investments in education with some of our online and the Idaho Digital Network and those kind of things, but those will take years to pay off in the future. And of course, looking at our tax policy, the role of the state. We just heard a little bit about what's happening in South Carolina and the things that they're doing as a state to encourage investment. We currently have more of a bottom-up process where the local economic development folks are the ones recruiting many of the jobs. The state does help them do that. They have products. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But we do not have a state-led process through the Department of Commerce that I could find. It's more of a we assist the locals at the local level. That is different in other states, and it's something they have figured out. They need to have the one-stop shop mentality for businesses looking to expand or relocate.
Mr. Eaton, you're starting to cut into Mr. Dunham's time.
Okay. I will hurry quickly along. We can provide better information about tax structure. We can provide new incentives. This is something that you can see if you look a little closer at the online when this is released. This is one that Oregon does. They have a one-stop shop. You call their business investment managers, and they will help you through the process with the local governments, local economic development folks. This is something that Tennessee does, and we have talked about this before. They had a six-year policy to get to this. See all of the business tax credits. Now, we know that we can't do all of those in Idaho. We've had those discussions many times. Some of them we've actually repealed, but there are some we can do. This is something that they put out as their mandate for the track that they were going to go down in 2003 when they started this process. They wanted to reduce red tape, make sure one size doesn't fit all, make job creation a partnership with these folks in the state, and look into the future about how they can be investing in education, investing in changing economies, tax credits, those kind of things. Their last 6 years, they have achieved relocation and expansion projects resulting in more than 190,000 new jobs through this program and $33 billion in capital investment. Idaho incentives, I'm not going to read them to you, you guys all know them. These are the incentives that we have, one of which is key is the investment tax credit. That's really our only incentive that we can offer some of these folks. There's a property tax at the local level, some new job tax credits. Those are directly off the Department of Commerce's website. One possible idea I did see in the Tennessee deal, and it's not, we would change it, I think, because we've been down the headquarters relocation road before, but they have a specific tax credit within that tax credit that deals with moving expenses. They have qualified headquarters that have to go through the process. We can run all this later, and I'll get that information to the committee. But the taxpayers must file and be approved with the department. And then here are the expense credits that they are allowed to take from bringing jobs to that state, either new businesses that come in or existing businesses that relocate employees into the state. It's a lot of money per position, and it can help give those corporations an incentive to move to a state like Idaho. Again, we'll do our part. The Idaho Association of Realtors will continue to work to craft policies that enhance and protect the real estate industry and the free transaction of real property. And if I didn't cut into too much of Mr. Dunham's time, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Questions of the committee? Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eaton, you talked about distressed properties in the real estate industry. Could you speak for just a moment about the rate of distressed properties coming onto the market today versus those going off the market? And do you track the growth of the distressed properties, because really the point of this panel is to determine what the economic viability is for both construction and real estate in the state, help us set a projection, and I think that's a key component.
Mr. Eaton, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Roberts, we don't track those specifically. I think we do have some component of that in our individual MLSs that can track it. But what I've seen through some of the national numbers, and I think we're reflective of that a little bit, is that it's about a third of the industry right now, a third to a half, depending on where you're at in the state. We expect that, I think, to continue for the next 2 to 3 years, I would imagine, as we burn through those properties. If you look at, and I have some graphs I can get you on the national level that I did not include here, that talk about how much we have in homes that are 30 days behind, how many homes are 90 days behind, and that trend is fairly stable right now. Until you see job growth, that trend probably will continue.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Eaton.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Denham, you're up.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll wait for my presentation to start.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Shakespeare had one of my favorite quotes of Shakespeare is, brevity is the soul of wit, and so I will be much more brief than Mr. Eaton. This morning, as I was getting ready, I happened to log onto Facebook, as I often do at home before I come to work, and I noticed that last night Senator Keogh had mentioned her participation in this committee and was hoping for a rosy outlook today. And I immediately thought of that really bad 1980 song about every rose has its thorn, and I fear that when I give the commercial and transportation construction outlook, I'm going to be the thorn in your rosy picture. My first official act, and I mentioned this last year when I started lobbying in 1984, was before the forerunner to this committee, then Senator Vern Lannon, who was out of the Silver Valley. Some of you may have heard of Vern Lannon, said, "Welcome to the circus, kid," and it's been an interesting experience. I have 20 years experience with the Idaho Association of Realtors, some time with BSU and IACI, and this will be my fourth legislative session with the Associated General Contractors of Idaho. So I have been through a lot of good times and bad times in the legislative process and in the state budget process. I did provide a handout taking into account a lot of the questions that were asked of us in the preliminary figures or preliminary packet that was sent out. I tried to provide you with some materials that you can take away. The first one is the economic impact of construction in the United States. It's a one-pager from our national organization, the Associated General Contractors of America. The next page is the economic impact of construction not only in the United States but in Idaho, which has some of the information on spending and construction employment and those sorts of things and construction industry pay. The next one has to do with construction employment, and I've highlighted Idaho in particular, and for some reason in many cases they lump logging and mining into construction, but it gives you a snapshot of some of the unemployment figures, and it breaks it down in certain areas of the state like Boise, Nampa, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho Falls, Lewiston, and Pocatello. The next couple pages are actually out of your own book, but I put them in there anyway. It's employment growth trends, as well as Idaho gross domestic product by industry, because one of the questions that I was asked was, where are we in terms of our contributions to the economy? So that information is there. Just briefly about the AGC in general, we were founded in 1934. We have 853 member companies throughout the state. That's down from our historic high of almost 1,100 in 2008. The economy is continuing to cause concern for our members and then as a result for our membership. Of the 853 companies, 88 are general contractors. That's down from 93 last year. The rest are specialty contractors, which are commonly called subcontractors, and associate members, which are companies that provide services to our members, such as CPAs, attorneys. We have four offices in Idaho, Boise, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho Falls, and Twin Falls. We recently moved our Coeur d'Alene office, so we're continuing to invest in the state. We have various member services throughout the state, such as a health plan. We cover over 6,000 Idahoans with Blue Cross of Idaho in a health plan. We provide safety training, environmental services, public policy, and we have our four plan rooms across the state where our members go to try and find projects that they can bid on. And I can tell you that plan room activity is down in terms of what they do. We do not represent residential construction. Sometimes you'll see all construction employment, and that is non-residential and residential lumped together, and where I can, I try and distinguish that. But just for your information, I represent highway contractors and commercial builders. Commercial construction is defined as schools, colleges, university buildings. BSU is a bright spot right now in the construction industry because of all the activity there, which is, by the way, financed by BSU students and not the state. retail and warehouse, highways and local roads, office, healthcare, sewer, religious, such as churches and temples and utilities. So what's the major change from my last three presentations to this committee? It's actually worse than we anticipated. We keep saying that we think it's temporary, that next year it's going to be better, and it hasn't gotten better. A lot of our members are saying they're not even sure they can see the light at the end of the tunnel. The credit crunch in the commercial world is continuing to really cripple our industry. Commercial real estate stagnation, there is definitely a lot of commercial property still available. So you combine that with the commercial credit crunch and you have properties that can't be financed because they can't get loans. And unless you have an owner-financed property or project on the docket, you can't even get a loan to build something new. So that's tough. Government budget crisis. I don't need to tell you about that. This is going to be probably the toughest session I've ever had the opportunity to participate in with what you're going to go through. Transportation funding continues to be a crisis. The governor's task force proved that with a $543 million shortfall. State and federal legislative impacts and the uncertainty, and I'll get into those in a minute. Some of the current economic influences that are affecting our industry, GDP is stagnant, personal income growth is stagnant. There is somewhat of a general acceleration nationally, but Idaho is lagging behind in that. We see no upturn at all in office, retail, warehouse rents or occupancies. In fact, rental rates are dropping in commercial properties. Again, loans for developers remain tight to unavailable. State and local tax shortfalls, we know there's going to be deeper spending cuts. I think some of the first things to go, frankly, are going to be building projects, whether it's on a state level or a local municipality level, so we don't see a lot of hope there. Federal spending helped, but it's going to decline, and when we say federal spending, everybody talks about how bad stimulus was, but frankly, the stimulus dollars did at least sustain jobs in Idaho. But a lot of those projects, the most obvious ones were construction and transportation, but there were a lot of other projects like energy efficiency in schools. Those have been rolled out and that's going to go away. Uncertainty about the federal, this is my other PowerPoint, I sent a new one. Price spikes for diesel, we are starting to see price spikes in some of the commodities that we use, but there's one other one that I have on my PowerPoint that you don't, and that's uncertainty about federal government policy impacts on business. Mr. Eaton referenced that. My members have no idea what the health care costs are going to be under the federal health care law. I was actually talking to one of the largest general contractors in the state this morning, and he told me that he has no idea if he's going to just tell his 200 employees that they don't have health care or not. That's an example of the uncertainty. We don't know what the financial reform is going to do to commercial construction and availability of credit. We don't know what environmental regulations are going to do to our industry. There is a very direct directive coming out of Washington, D.C. that this administration said that were to be enforcement rather than educational. So we're seeing more emphasis in terms of enforcement on OSHA and a variety of other things that are starting to cost my members a lot of money in addition to just the uncertainty. So with that rosy picture, the concerns are continuing. We're seeing a lot more companies that are filing bankruptcy. When we lose a member company, and don't get me wrong, we actually have more new members in the Idaho AGC in 2010 than we had in 2009, but nevertheless we've had an overall drop. But in the ones that drop, we talk to them and a lot of them have filed bankruptcy. We're having more and more companies that are continuing with their layoffs, they're contracting and they're keeping key employees. Those employees are doing a lot more than they used to do because they're having to absorb multiple jobs. Our plan room activity in the four areas across the state is much less than it has been, and the copies that we provide are less. That's simply because there's not as many projects. You don't go into a plan room when there's not a lot of projects. We have multiple bidders on jobs that used to attract a few. I met with another contractor this morning, and he said that recently on a $500,000 job, there were 27 bidders, many of whom were rather large commercial general contractors. We're seeing company trim benefits. I've had to do that in my own organization with my own staff, but lots of construction companies are doing that. There's an overall perception in my industry that the government fails to see the prudence of long-term funding and investment into infrastructure. There's a lot of big projects that are coming to a close. Garvey's an example of that, and we're finishing out Garvey. We hope that the legislature sees fit to provide more authorization. So there's just an overall sense of foreboding and unease in our industry. Specifically, the impact of construction in Idaho's economy. Mr. Eaton referenced the combined impact of real estate, which includes construction. But if you segregate just construction, and this is one of those times when it's both residential and non-residential, all construction accounted for 6.7% of the gross state product in 99. It's now closer to 5%. And construction employment continues to slide. Just in a one-year period, we've lost 15% of our workforce again. We're now 50 out of 51, and that's kind of reverse logic. Nevada is the only state that had worse than us, and one of the territories. So, construction employment, you can see some figures there. We were 42,800 workers in 08, and the most recent one that I have is a little more updated than this. We had 27,900 in October. So, what you're seeing is we have lost 40% of the construction jobs in the last 4 years in the state of Idaho. We are currently at December 1994 construction employment levels. Graphically, here's a national map just to give you a sense of where Idaho is. And this is another, the one-year figure. You can see Idaho there at 16%. Sometimes it's 15, sometimes 16, depending on rounding. Nevada had 22%. This is the change since 06 when construction employment peaked, and again we're at 48%. You can see that Nevada and Arizona have the dubious distinction of having worse than us. Construction spending level, I don't anticipate this is going to improve anything in Idaho. Construction spending in the state and in the nation peaked in March of 06 and has fallen continuously. Through August of 10, when we had our last reading. The total decrease over these 4.5 years is more than a third, including a 10% decline in the last 12 months alone. Private non-residential construction did grow strongly in 2006 and 7, but has tumbled, falling 24% in the last 12 months alone. In addition, these are some of the other factors that we're dealing with. There's been discussion about all the continuing resolutions in Congress. One of the things that half of my membership needs in order to operate is a 6-year transportation highway bill out of Congress. And Congress has consistently failed to do that, so they operate on a continuing resolution. You can't plan highways if you don't know whether you're going to have a 6-year amount of money. So that's a problem, and Congress just did it again. Construction credit is a problem. We know what's going to happen with the state budget. We know what's happening with local budgets. And basically, we think the worst is yet to come in our industry. So in summary, we predict that it's going to be challenging for us at the very least. There are a couple glimmers of hope, frankly, and I'm hopeful about those. The City of Boise, the Planning and Zoning Commission here just approved the JUMP project, which is the Jack's Urban Meeting Place. It's a $70 million facility in downtown Boise. The general contractor is out of Oregon, but they're going to hire a lot of Idaho subcontractors to work on that project. That was a 2-year process to get that project through, and it hasn't even broken ground yet. But that is going to be a positive impact. The Areva project in eastern Idaho is a bright spot in our industry, and we have a lot of our members from around the state who are looking at eastern Idaho. BSU continues to build, but again, they're doing it with student dollars. And again, I'll make only one lobbying plea, and that's for another round of Garvey. So with that, Senator Keel, I'm sorry that wasn't rosy, but are there any questions? I do think I got you back on schedule.
Mr. Denham, we are going to call you the thorn. And just one comment, the economic outlook presentation that I heard at the NCSL meeting, the speaker suggested that there was a 15-year supply of office space right now across the United States. That's absolutely astounding.
Mr. Chairman, I think most of that's an Eagle. district, I'm sorry.
Representative Burgoyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dunham, I'd be interested to know if you can tell me what percentage of your industry is private sector and what percentage is public sector projects?
Mr. Dunham.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burgoyne, I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head, but I'll look into it and I'll get back to you.
Mr. Chairman, one more
follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Dunham. And another question is, you made your plea regarding Garvey. I'm wondering, I saw on the one of your PowerPoint charts there, you had some infrastructure issues listed, education and other infrastructure projects. Are you suggesting that this legislature can come up with the money to do those things, or are we just going to hunker down and grit our teeth and try to get through the next several years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burgoyne, if I didn't make it clear, I fully appreciate the financial dilemma that you're facing as legislators, and we don't expect there to be a hidden pot of gold in any manner for a lot of those infrastructure projects. And but what we're saying is that we think that Garvey is an exception to that rule, and we think that bonding program has been effective. But when it comes to building buildings, when it comes to, you know, hospitals and those sorts of things, there's not a lot the legislature can do in that regard.
Thank you.
Representative Kilburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dunn, just have you seen any impact at all from the passage of the constitutional amendments, which basically relax some of the criteria for funding, local government funding?
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen, I have not yet seen that. We supported all of those initiatives from the AGC standpoint simply because we think there will be a positive impact. But right now, we haven't seen anything. That could be one of the glimmers of hope.
Representative Henderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mark. I guess we're all familiar with the Garvey program. I would like to, we now have 4 or 5 years experience with that, and I'd like to know, what has been the success rate of Idaho contractors bidding for those projects? And the second part of the question is, where when out-of-state contractor won the contract, how well did Idaho residents make out becoming employees to build those projects?
Mr. Dunham.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, I think the majority of the Garvey projects have gone to Idaho-based companies. And I don't have the exact figure, but I can get that relatively easy. I do know that, for example, the Sandpoint Bypass is a Montana contractor. But I think the vast majority of them have been Idaho contractors. And I'm also aware that they tend to hire a lot of suppliers and subcontractors from the state of Idaho.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mark. In your opinion, is there anything the legislature could do to help assure that contracts like that really work to the benefit of Idaho residents?
Mr. Dunham.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, that's a really good question, and it is certainly something that is discussed often, especially when an out-of-state contractor gets a big job in Idaho. On the other hand, I have fielded complaints from the state of Montana when an Idaho contractor gets a huge project in Miles City. And so when you start putting in quotas or percentages or things like that, you end up almost having a war between the states. And so my members have been very reluctant to try and pursue anything like that simply because right now the vast majority of my members are having to seek work outside of the state of Idaho in order to survive.
Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We look forward to a more optimistic presentation next year.
Me too.
Next up in our closing act for the day, University of Idaho College of Agriculture, Dean Hamill. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm between you and dinner, and that should make you think of food, but also importantly, now that everybody else has got the thorns, I like to think of myself as a rose. And so with that, we'll move forward. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to present before you today on the situation with agriculture in the state as an industry. It's broad-based, as you know. It's throughout the state. And I think what I'd like to do is spend some time in, first of all, talking about 2010 forecast, and the forecast is on a calendar year, so it'll be 2010 compared back against 2009 for crop year. pardon me, a calendar, not a crop year comparison. And I also looked at the 2011 outlook, and I'd like to spend just a bit of time looking at agriculture's contribution to Idaho's economy as a major industry within a state, and both a stabilizing factor as well as a providing a solid foundation to the state's economy. Idaho cash receipts, for the most part, farm cash receipts were up 12% increase in the 2010 over 2009. Of course, we went through the 2008 and 2009 period. It's up. It's still below the high in the 2008 that we had, but it's they are moving up. Primarily, that is in response to the livestock, where there was some recovery in dairy in 2010, as well as the higher beef prices and the beef supports. Moving on, that the livestock industry as a whole, dairy, milk, dairy, and beef, and other livestock has regained its leadership overall in the Idaho farm receipts. And I want to point these out. This is the commodities, the price, and the value of those commodities at the farm gate, not moving on and then doing any value added to those. So livestock has regained. It's now 55% of the total compared to the crops. In a quick snapshot and moving through these and staying for the most part with the majors, both in milk and in cattle. Milk was up 36%. Again, dairy's largest revenue producer. However, they've gone through and are going through a very traumatic time. The production's been up about 7%. Prices have come back up, and we'll talk a little bit more about those. Rebounded is the term, but it's not pretty. There's $520 million more, but still considerably less when you think about the billion-dollar increase in farm receipts that they suffered in 2009, over $1 billion. The major crops, cattle and calves, are up 16%. The inventory, that is the number of head, are down. That's across the nation as well as in Idaho, but the prices are up. So there's a good future there, and we'll talk more about that. Potatoes, wheat, barley, for the most part, wheat prices were up, but production was down. It's still the Idaho's, the potatoes were Idaho's number one revenue crop, and they were down 12%. Wheat was up 6%, primarily due to response of the increase in production. However, they're coming on with 2010 for a stronger price for their in per bushel on wheat and cereals in general. If we look at Idaho's farm cash receipts on a real dollar basis using 2008 as the base, looking over the past 40 years, you'll see in generally there's been some fluctuation around an average. There's about a 1.7% growth. The 2010 is about $5.6 billion. Again, this is in real dollars, 37% above the 41-year average overall. And so for the most part, this is ag is a stable on real dollars basis, stable and somewhat increasing basis within the state, looking at real dollars compared to the nominal. The Idaho farm net farm income was up $1.44 billion, 55% above 2009, which is about $508 million, still considerably less than the 2000 of 2008. The revenues, for the most part, livestock receipts in the area, livestock were up, crops were down, government payments decreased again, and there's some support. And so far as the expenses, as one might imagine, where income is the difference between revenue and expenses, with your inputs and energy-related type of inputs, fertilizer and so forth, have increased. And so, for the most part, they're still, and that will be continuing into the future. We now look at Idaho net farm income. This, for the most part, is, again, in real dollars. And this is value, this is, for the most part, what it shows. I want to show, look at the area from about 2000 on versus the 70s. You've seen a large amount of variation and volatility, again, from year to year, where we had a great deal of stability in the 90s. And so what that shows is, for the most part, based on these things, fluctuating futures, prices of the commodities, that are paid for, and also cost of inputs and so forth, that there's a real volatility. And the ag, this will force the farmers in, I think, to look at the manage their taxes and basis of what they need to do, as well as manage their risk more. So that's going to have to look at crops, the type of things they do, and also manage how they market those crops across the basis. Before I get carried too far away, I'd like to introduce Dr. Garth Taylor. He's one of these, along with three other ag economists, state of Idaho, that helped prepare this. And I do want to point out, I'm a soil scientist and a layman that's trying to bring it down to some level that you can understand it from an economist. But we'll let him answer some questions later as they come up, and so you'll understand why I'm a soil scientist, not an economist. Net value added is the basically defined by the USDA as it's the return back to society versus the net farm income, which is a return back to the farmer. As you can see now in real dollars, there's been a real, in 2010, 20% above the 40-year average in 2008 dollars. And so the adding back, what that says is agriculture adds back the net value back to the state in a considerable fashion. We'll look at that. The one thing you always ask about is the direct government payments to Idaho agriculture in 1950 to 2001. Idaho payments this year were about $130 million, only about 9% of the net farm income. There, you notice that small map off to the right that shows where a great deal of your support payments go. Again, the support payments are for your five major crops, corn, wheat, soybeans, cotton, and rice. We only have wheat that you have farm supports on. Notice also on the graph there in millions of dollars that you had a real rise in farm payments in the CRP era of the 80s to 85. And then since that's starting to come out, there's a decline in there. So for the most part, the production side of things, production supports in the state about $130 million, about 47%. Production support about 25%, conservation programs, energy and disaster accounts for about 15%, and then price supports around 11% of that number. But that is on the decline. Again, Idaho's not a major player in that as for the most part, because wheat is the only crop in the commodity, Title I commodity program. So move on to one thing that I want to point out here is what you're seeing here is a difference in the comparison between the prices paid. That's production interest taxes, or production inputs, interest, taxes, and wages versus prices received by the producer paid for their commodity. You'll note that from about 96 on, for the most part, there's been an increasing gap between those two, such that there's a 39% proxy right now, 40% gap. Between those prices that the producer pays to do a crop versus the prices received. So that does cause some stress on the agriculture industry and the commodities at the farm level. However, the thing is, if you look at this and do some comparison here in looking at the 80s and the farm crisis of the 80s versus the farm crisis, what's happening right now in your debt to equity or debt to asset, they're about 50% below what they were. However, this is national data, not Idaho data, and from the USDA. And so one can imagine, for the most part, there's probably a pretty close correlation between your crops and, say, beef in the dairy industry. There's going to be a little more, I'd say your debt to equity or debt to asset would be a little bit more stressed in that particular situation. But overall, across this country, ag is in pretty good shape on the debt to equity. So where does that put us? Idaho Agriculture Outlook 2011 and beyond. The plus is the economic recovery should increase the domestic and export demand. We've got a weak dollar right now, and there's low interest rates. On the minus side of that, credit availability is going to be an issue. Banks are having to change. You've got a number of things happening. Fuel prices will continue to increase, and then those things that are related to increased energy, such as your fertilizer and other types of inputs that are on the farm level, are going to increase also. So between those two, you're going to have those things looking at you, and they're pretty well similar to what has been on. Interesting, I want to put in the ethanol thing here as we move through, and how that's impacting some of the price structure in feed barley and some of our other commodities that we have. we look at dairy outlook, and again, this is about as exciting as it gets for an economist sitting at the back room of a university. We don't let them out very much. But the Idaho dairy's continued expansion. The 10-year average here in Idaho in the past has been about 20,000 head per year. The number given there for 2010 is a USDA number, 21,000. Idaho is presently ranked third or fourth after California and Wisconsin. The price dropped considerably down to about $9, $10 per class three, has moved up slightly. We're expecting to have a 1440 to 1530 range. However, that's combined with higher feed costs, higher inputs, and cash receipts will be up. But dairy is in a considerable quandary right now. If you'll note here, in this graph, you'll have the production, or pardon me, the price on a monthly basis starting in January of 07. The red dashed line there is just slightly at the bottom end of what the required cost, or required amount that is required to break even in production costs. And so, but I know I put the word rebound in there, in that if you look at the prices in the prior to January of 08 and the decline in 08, versus where they are now, they have rebounded, but that's the big thing. But they're nowhere near back to where they need to be. But and so we're still in the first part of 2010 here, or 11. Pardon me. They're going to waver a bit. So it's improved, but they're still considerably below where they were. The one thing I do want to point out, looking over the last since 1980. And 2008 is a base in real dollars. So if you look at the price, it has declined. The major improvement or increase in dairy has been on the production side, and that's both in the number of cows as well as in the amount of milk produced per cow. Per cow basis in that period of 30 years, the cow pounds of milk per cows have increased two times, and the number of cows have increased 400%. So you multiply those two together. That has, for the most part, increased in production, and therefore, where the price has gone down, you've still seen that dairy's become a considerable player and will continue to be as things get better. Beef outlook, the U.S. beef cow herd is the smallest since 1963. Beef production is only 3% below the record. They've gotten a lot more efficient. You've got bigger animals. They produce better. Right now, what the futures are for cattle and live beef are very good. If you look at that in the future, that combined with the smaller herds, and then also the fact that you're going to have that lag in period of increase in the herd size, that the prices are going to look good in the future. For that, demand for beef is high. I want to point out the corn price is uncertainty. That price, because you know they have the utilized dollars, this federal program to support ethanol production, corn primarily going into that, and that's for ethanol rather than feed, tends to seriously impact what happens across many, many levels. Potato outlook, prices are higher early in the year. Seed price up, cash receipts will be up, production I think will be an increased acreage, and then they'll have higher yields. That's always a question. The one thing we can say about our producers, they tend to produce very well, and there's an advantage to the consumer for all of this. Wheat outlook, lower world production will support improved prices. The main thing is look at the bottom of stocks for 2010, 2011. The world stocks are down 11%. The U.S. stocks are down 13%. You've got the issues in production in Russia. You've got the issues in production in Australia and also in Argentina and Brazil. And those are going to somebody else's hell, so to speak, is our heaven. And that's the way it is in ag, but that will maintain, and the prices right now in the futures for grain are increased. And so you will be looking at that as higher prices. So what that will do also is to, looking at these, say, riskier crops and sugar beets and others within the state, you may see producers move to what they consider a more stable and lower risk crop for production. Barley outlook, again, you have higher, price will be higher for feed and malt. Barley due to stronger corn prices. The stronger corn prices are for a couple of things. Number one, there's a large amount of corn going into the ethanol. There's been a 36% demand increase for corn for ethanol production. Along with the low stocks, you're going to drive the price up when the world stocks down. So with that, we'll see probably production acreage will be stable, but the cash receipts will be up in both feed and malt barley. The sugar beet outlook is a one of a question. For the most part, if you look at RUR, the Roundup Ready sugar beets, there's been, of course, the litigation and so forth. There's been a court ruling that they can move forward with that. However, before they get the environmental impact study completed, but again, that does, because there's the judicial side of that and the movement that can change at any moment. At the same time, with that, you're going to grow these, there's going to be a significant and rather stringent monitoring program as you move forward. There was a seed availability question, whether you have the Roundup Ready or do you have the just the conventional or the regular, I'll call them the regular sugar beet seed. It's not as much a program. However, getting back to where you have these issues of risk around the sugar beet, with lower risk in some of your other crops, such as your cereals, your barley, grain, then you'll see a movement possibly towards that. But those are the types of things that the growers are going to have to do. Bottom line, cash receipts, that is at the farm gate, will be about 3% above the 2010 for 2011. Net farm income will be about the same. And this is, I think, my opinion, and Garth can argue with that a little bit, or he might not, is probably erring on the conservative side with agriculture and with what agriculture is for this state. So with that, if I might, I'm going to move into the contribution of what I'd like to say is the contribution of agriculture to Idaho's economy. So you have the economic output, I mean the financial condition of ag that I've just basically gone through, and I want to point out is there's two things here. There's this study right here, the contribution of agriculture to Idaho's economy that was done for 2006. We have gotten the data from the U.S. Department of Commerce, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and for the 2008, or 7, 8, and 9, we're working through that, and I'm going to do some comparisons with 2006, which was prior to the decline of 2008, the economic decline, and then also looking at 2009, which follows after that, to see where ag sets and what its contribution in the state is. So with that, there's two ways to look at it. There's a gross versus a base economy. The gross is how do you look at that? How do you slice that pie? And it's kind of the basis for which you compare. Gross is very simple. If you've got 30 farms, you've got 30 farmers, so that's 30 jobs, and that's and those dollars that come back, it's very simply, it's what directly to that given sector, the economic activity accounts for that. The base, on the other hand, for sales, value-added jobs, looks at the economic activity in all sectors that are driven by what's happening in a given sector. So, for instance, this would be new money, if there's a large trucking industry, but with agriculture, because of that shipping, then for agricultural commodities as well as other types of things, produce or manufacture, that type of thing, then ag is given that contribution of the trucking industry or service industry as part of its slice of the pie, as is tech, as is the other things. Everybody are given the equal parts based on this and treated equally. So that's the base, and that's the way we'll be looking at this. To give an example, the gross versus base jobs, this is for 2006, the pie on the left under as your gross jobs for 2006 based on around 900,000 total jobs. You can see that agribusiness accounted about, this is the simple look, about 6% of that. Service was a huge portion, about 50% of that, and then tech manufacturing and other manufacturing was about 5%. So you look at that as based on the simple. Now if you move over to the base where everybody gets their share of what has happened, what does ag contribute to service, what does tech contribute to service, what is forest and mines contributed service and so forth, or trade, or however how much the service contribute back to then ag and so forth. Look at the base jobs, you can see that agribusiness accounts for in 2006 about 70% of the jobs in the state, and comparing, I guess you could if you want to, tech manufacturing, which is about 13%. So ag was a major player in jobs. If you look now for 2009, following everything. You see the ag business now, and that's everything associated with agriculture, what ag contributes to. The number of jobs, about 60% of the jobs in the state, and you can see a notable decline in others in the area of tech manufacture compared to what they were and in some of the other areas. So what that states is, and we all know that, and I think it's been pointed out in looking at things, that agriculture is spread throughout the state, both rural and urban. There's a economic development, economic stabilization and support at all levels, whether it's in manufacture, food manufacture within the urban areas and or in the rural areas. When that dollar goes out, states, ag is worldwide, I mean statewide, and not limited, and it is also a major contributor and a stabilizer effect to then the economy of Idaho. Now, if you look at the base supports exports in 2006, agriculture and agribusiness and high-tech manufacturing account about 50% of that. And that's quite large. This is a matter of going out of the $34 billion at the time. Well, this one's a little strange. I don't didn't translate. Okay. Well, look at this. I don't know where the big circle in the center came from. But for the most part, what I do want to point out is looked at a little differently. Farm and food manufacture, which are the agribusiness, in 2009, that is following the deal, still account for about 25% of the exports. And if you look at things like other manufacturing, tech manufacturing, they have declined considerably within that. So that again gets back to the stable nature of what agriculture and the industry does for this state and the basis of its economy, both in exports and in jobs. Now the big aspect here is this pie shows economic base output in sales. That is everything that's exported and sold outside the state and what each sector brings back into the state in new dollars to Idaho. And agribusiness accounts for 20% of that. So with that, I'd like to point out that agriculture is very important. That's why it's a rose, and I'm a rose standing here telling you that. But ag is important in that it provides stability on an annual basis to your economy compared to the previous year, and it also provides a good solid foundation upon which everything else sets from year to year. Here's a way to look at that. If you look at agriculture and economic stability, note ag is the blue line, the total state is the red line, and your high-tech manufacturing, give you an example, and you've seen this up and down. There's state agriculture is a state business. You can't move agriculture. Everything's within the state foundation. If you don't get up and move agriculture, it's around and it's been growing and very much a contributor. Where your high tech and some of your other manufacturing, I think that's been pointed out, what gets them to come in, what keeps them in, what versus they can move out. It's hard to take 1,000 acres and move it outside the state and start your operation elsewhere. But so for that, I just do want to point out that agriculture was the growth and stability across the years. However, I do when I always pound on you every year because of this. You look at this, and this is what Senator Hill asked last time. What is the impact of the development in this state? Your total cropland, and if you look at your resource base in Idaho since 1987, 2007, so the last couple of decades, has decreased significantly. And you'll notice also there's another slide towards the end of the very back that shows land and farms, but that includes all land in all farms, the 5-acre farmettes and so forth, and that's been a significant decline. This is happening due to development, and I implore you that for the most part, if you look, let's use the Treasure Valley here, best use is not orchards of houses planted on your prime land in Idaho. There needs to be some type of program in place to look at development, to buy out the development capability and keep that in farmland for the future. That it is a base. Idaho is a natural ag and an ag and natural resource base, and this is what's happening, and it's happening across the state, I might add. You know, one other way to look at this, look at our ag research extension contribution. I've had if you look on the left, there's the growth in let's look at the potato cash receipts. And it's given in components. If you have so many acres, you get so many potatoes per acre times the price, you'll have your total revenues. On the left is your nominal basis. However, then you do that on a real basis, looking at it with a 2008 base, then you'll note that the real price has decreased over the 20-year period 73%. The amount of acres is about the same in growth, total potato production. However, if you look, the improvement in yield is 34.1%. Now, I'm not stating there with that circle that that is all contributed to what we do within the college and also throughout this state. It's also to the great production capability, better efficiencies that the farmers have put into place, the producers put into place, but it does get back to the fact that the improvement in varieties, higher yields, better quality, better able to resist diseases and compete with pests and plants and weeds, and so that is our playground and that's where we play. Also, there's an added benefit, and I want to point out the negative 38% in total revenues. That is a drop in the price of things, and that is a benefit, quite frankly, to the consumer. Our producers are very efficient in what they do, both in Idaho and in the nation. They tend to grow more. They drive prices down over time. It's a benefit to the consumer, and that's a benefit directly to improvement in yields. Here's the same thing in wheat. Acreage about the same. However, the improvement primarily has been in the area of yield, and that gets back to varieties, improved techniques, and agronomics, and so forth. So I want to point out there's two areas here, protect your resource and also invest in ag research and also in what and the level of production for the producer, because ag is you may not say it's number one, I will, but it's still a major player in this state and it will be in years to come. So with that, I will end, and I'm available for any questions, or Dr. Taylor is definitely available for questions.
Thank you, Dean Hamill. Questions of the committee? Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John and maybe Garth and maybe Senator Hill can chime in on this as well. One of the questions that we continually ask at this time of the year here in Boise and trying to determine what the tax revenues would be is what's happened with the agriculture industries, and you've shown that there has been some increase in net farm income. But along with that, most of us farmers have the ability to try to take those profits and not send them to government to pay taxes, but we try to invest in updating equipment, and therefore it brings up the question of the depreciation and capital investment in agricultural operations. There's 179 depreciation, which is written off. I think those limits have been raised this year. Also, other types of depreciation, straight line or accelerated depreciation. Do you have any indication of what type of purchases have been delayed for the last several years during leaner times in agriculture, and where those dollars may be invested now and written off as an expense, which then translates into a lower tax that's paid on the income tax forms?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts, that is always a question asked every year, and the producers are wily in that they can also sell the crop in the next calendar year versus in this calendar year. So because that question is beyond my capability, I'm going to turn that over to Dr. Taylor.
Dr. Taylor,
welcome. You have to answer that. I knew it was coming.
Well, every year we talk about taxes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts. Every year we talk about taxes, and we just love to do some forecast on how much agriculture contributes to taxes. Let me preface one thing. Look at that slide that says the volatility of your net revenues, your bottom line for it. Just look at it. This is where I would counsel each of you. That's what kills farmers or makes them. We had a big plus year, the third largest ever in net. The third largest ever. But it didn't make up for last year's drop. And this comes right back to where you're, how much are they writing off, you know, to make up for that? This is your drop. This is why I wouldn't trust this Garth's forecast on nets as far as I could spit a piano. And they'll do that. When it looks like it's really good, they're going to write more of it off.
and they're going to see Senator Hill and do it. And that's all there is to it. And quite legitimately so. But what comes back to it, I think, is more important, is what comes back to your responsibility on this, is forecasting how much revenues are, you know, tax revenues you're going to get out of agriculture. And it's going to be far more volatile, as you saw, as going up and down like that. And that's the, I can't answer the exact amounts. You can go back and look through the itemized on the table on the rear of this bulletin here and get a little bit more of the idea of how much taxes or something like that. But they're going to do that very heavily, and they're going to do it more and more when these volatilities come back into it. More and more they're going to sharpen that pencil. Also, a greater type of thing from the farmer's perspective is their management of risk marketing and these programs that they're going to have to do for contracting and stuff like that to manage this risk and prices. That they're just going to have to do that, or they're going to get, they're going to go, they're going to be out of the whole situation. And I would, the other thing that I would really counsel when you look at this type of situation, that's an excellent question, but it's also in terms of the dairy industry and how much they can write off in terms of that cow depreciation and stuff like that. That's one of the big problems I think we're really going to look at in terms of the volatility. And again, it's going to come back to haunt you as far as the taxes generated from this agriculture.
Representative Robinson, if I may add to that, just when I did, and that is the volatility, and we're looking at basically farm-based revenue on that. I think if you look at the food manufacturer as well as, you know, milk's down, the cheese production is enhanced. And I want to point out that what I've talked about is there's a lot more weak dollar, greater amount of exports of our commodities and also of our value-added or manufactured products. And I think that those are new dollars back to Idaho. So you're primarily looking at the limited, what is the ag, what is the tax revenue based on the net farm income. There's also the other, all the other revenues are brought back, both the new dollars back to the state in export as well as the other activities and both supporting jobs from agriculture throughout the state, both rural and urban.
Follow-up?
Well, maybe to just comment, Mr. Chairman, the point to be made is that just because we have increased revenues in the agriculture industry does not necessarily equate to a comparable or equal amount in revenues to state or federal government revenue side. And I'm sure in the next few weeks and months, as Senator Hill's counterparts throughout the state start doing tax returns for all of those in the agricultural industry, it will be a question I know I'll be asking those CPAs in my area. What's the trend? What do you see happening as far as actual taxable income coming out of the agricultural industries? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Lefebvre.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that question, which I really appreciate, I thought that was a great question, Representative Roberts. The contributions that, I mean, may have come back to the state, I imagine there are some purchasing going on, and I don't know what percentage of it falls under the production exemption and various exemptions, and so I don't know what taxes we would get from that. But we do have a fair bit of impact on the economy just through the purchasing that goes on when, you know, you're replacing broken items and stuff like that, and the jobs that may either sustain or create over time. And I don't know if you've done any work on, you know, how quickly those two things pair up in an area or how those track. I guess it's fairly complex, so I know it would be hard, but I'd love your comment on that anyway.
Doctor?
I guess that steers for me. Mr. Chairman, Senator Goldfield. The one thing that I would really point out with it, that's really an excellent question. And it has to do with you look at the volatility so much in the net for the farmer. And it's no denying it's there. And even it'll be more volatile for you because of that, for your problems. But what I think the gist of what you're pointing at is how is it volatile for the people who, that the farmer buy the seed in Walmart and the stuff like that? It's not. That's one of the stabilizing influences of agriculture. It doesn't matter where milk is $10 or if it's $20 those cows still have to be milked. That hay still has to be paid for. That barn still has to be painted. Everything, virtually, the only person is that mom doesn't get a new future refrigerator, the old man doesn't get his new pickup. And those things can be, you know, those you can eat into your capital, your new pickup for a few years out of that type of situation. But the vast majority of those expenses is still stays in place. And that's why we see, when we see, you listen to the other, you know, Mr. Fick up here talking about how the stability in some of these other, the rural areas in the economy have stayed very stable throughout the recession. Because the even though the agriculture, we had a huge drop in the net last year, terrible, 50-some-odd percent drop in it. And yet those areas stay very stable. It's because of that, that they come back in there. They have to. They just cannot stop recession. I wish you wouldn't eat anything, the cow, you know. It doesn't happen that way. So, and that's why what you look at when you see these impacts in the economy, when you see when the pie charts and stuff like that, what you'll see is agriculture is always number one. Is because the ripple effects stay in place. They're more tied to the gross than they are to the net. Whereas Micron is tied to the net, a lot of that type of stuff. And that's why the biggest reason when those things, that ag stays number one in its ranking as the number one industry in the state.
Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. Committee, I think we've completed our agenda for the day. Tomorrow we start at 8 a.m. promptly. We are Senator Keel.
I'm sorry. I was curious about the schedule tomorrow and noticing that we have a speaker that starts at 11:20 and goes for 20 minutes. And my understanding was for those folks going to the inauguration, they're supposed to be outside their respective chambers at 11:30. And so I was curious what the co-chair's plans were tomorrow in regards to the time schedule for the inauguration.
Good Senator, we're going to squeeze. Is that good enough? All right. We're adjourned then.